Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the joint hearing between the House Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division and the Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division. We have a pretty ambitious agenda this morning because we knew it's kind of hard for people to come in for a whole, for one small hearing. So we put two big issues together into a hearing today, and hopefully we'll do this in a timely manner. I guess I'll start off chairing, and then I'll switch over with Representative Wagenius for the second part of the hearing. So we'll start with, we don't have to do approval of the minutes. We'll start with the PCA, and we would like to hear an update on what's happening with TMDL, what progress has been made. We did put some directives into the appropriations bill to try to focus on outcomes of our TMDL process and of making the best use of the dollars that we have. So we're interested to hear about your perspective on how that's moving forward. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the manager of the Minnesota Pollution and Control Agency's Water Monitoring Section, and with me is Glenn Suda, who's the manager of the Water Subsection. And today we're here to provide you with an update on TMDLs, impaired waters, and our progress implementing the Clean Water Legacy Act. So in this presentation, we'll provide brief background information, and then we'll update you on our progress monitoring the state's lakes and streams and developing TMDL projects. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about next steps for this effort. So first, a little bit of background. The concept of impaired waters comes from the Clean Water Act, and the Act requires all states to assess their lakes and streams and rivers to determine if they're meeting water quality standards, and then those lakes and streams and rivers that don't meet standards to list those on what's called the impaired waters list. And that's the list of waters not meeting standards. It's due every April 1st of even-numbered years to the Environmental Protection Agency. And then the final decision-making on the impaired waters list is the Environmental Protection Agency. So they approve or disapprove the state's list. Our most recent list, then, was approved by EPA, and that was the list that we submitted for the April 1st, 2008 deadline. So once we've identified impaired waters, the next step is to identify the sources and the reductions that are needed in order to return those waters to meeting water quality. And that's the TMDL study or the TMDL project phase. And then finally, an implementation plan is developed and is implemented in order to reach that goal of restoring the water quality so the standards are being met. And then the last step is to reevaluate that water quality to see if the standards are in fact being met. Back in 2006, the Clean Water Legacy Act was enacted to provide guidance and resources to state agencies, including the Pollution Control Agency, to implement these Clean Water Act requirements. And the Clean Water Legacy Act really establishes Minnesota as a leader in TMDL development and restoration and protection efforts for waters of the state. As a part of the Clean Water Legacy Act passage, then, the financial resources provided involved first a one-year appropriation of $25 million to all state agencies, of which, and that was for fiscal year 2007, and of which just over $5 million went to the Pollution Control Agency. Then for the fiscal years 2008-2009 biennium, a total of $54 million was appropriated to all of the agencies for implementing the Act. And of that, the PCA received a one-time appropriation of just over $30 million, which included about $12.6 million for monitoring and assessment, and about $18 million for developing those TMDL projects. Now, with this funding, the PCA has ramped up our effort to monitor and assess our lakes and streams, and to complete the TMDL projects needed to identify how to restore impaired waters to meeting water quality standards. A really important component of the Clean Water Legacy Act impaired waters work is that monitoring and assessment piece. The Pollution Control Agency has a strategy for monitoring all of our lakes and streams over a 10-year cycle that relies on four data collection components. The first is the monitoring that the PCA does itself. The second is monitoring that's done by other state agencies and other local units of government, such as counties and cities and watershed districts. Then we also rely on remote sensing to help provide a snapshot of information about water quality, particularly for lakes, and that provides guidance as to where to do more follow-up in-depth monitoring. And finally, the fourth and really important component of this monitoring effort is citizen monitoring. The work being done by lake associations, by local river groups, by individuals that are going out and collecting information about their lakes and streams and providing that to the state agencies so we can use that to assess water quality. The goal of this whole effort then is 100% coverage of our monitoring our lakes and streams on a 10-year cycle. Now, coverage doesn't mean that we're going to monitor every single of Minnesota's 12,200 lakes that are greater than 10 acres or the 105,000 river miles. But what it does mean is that we're focusing on priority lakes and priority streams. So we're getting a good picture of the status of the water quality of our water resources and identifying where we have problems and where we don't, and we need to protect good quality. The next three graphs then, or the next three slides, are going to show the outcomes of the Act so far with respect to our monitoring and assessment.
Excuse me, Representative Ligini.
You're talking about a 10% 10-year cycle, the priority waters.
Mm-hmm.
What's the number then of the priority lakes? You said how many lakes we have. What's the number you're actually doing?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, we are focused, the Pollution Control Agency is focused on monitoring all of the lakes that are 500 acres or larger. There's about 650 lakes that fall into that category, about 800 total basins. We have some lakes that are divided into multiple basins. And then we're also focused on monitoring the streams down to about the 25 square mile drainage area, so the kind of the amount of land that drains into that stream. There's about 5,000 sites then that we're looking at monitoring over that 10-year period. And then we also have a goal of monitoring at least 25% of the lakes that are between 100 and 500 acres.
How many is that?
There are, I believe, about 2,500 lakes in that category. So trying to get at least 25% of those. One of the challenges, particularly with lakes, but also with streams in some cases, is not all of our lakes and streams are accessible. We have a number of them in the boundary waters that are very difficult to get to, but we have lakes that don't have public accesses or maybe even aren't developed, so there isn't a way to get into those waters. So we're really trying to focus on those waters that get recreational use, that have a fishery that is accessed by humans, things like that, as a way to prioritize. That's part of the reason for not trying to access all of the lakes. The other thing is that the remote sensing does provide us with a picture of all lakes greater than 10 acres in size. We do get that snapshot information and then use that to help focus on where to do that more detailed follow-up monitoring.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
So this next slide shows how the stream monitoring has increased in Minnesota under the Clean Water Legacy Act. And the graph on the left shows the number of sites that we can monitor each year, which has increased beginning with LCCMR funding back in fiscal year 2004. And then you can see the increase that was associated with the passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act. For fiscal years 2010 and 2011, those are projections of the level of continued activity that would be needed to meet that goal of assessing all of our watersheds and assessing those priority streams on that 10-year cycle. Then on the right, you can see the actual locations of the monitoring sites through fiscal year 2009. And the triangles are the locations of the annual load monitoring stations being established at the outlets of our major watersheds. So basically what we're doing there is working with the Department of Natural Resources, the U.S. Geological Survey, and other partners like the Metropolitan Council to establish permanent monitoring stations there to look at the volume of water that's passing through those outlets and then also the quality of that water as well. And as you can see, most of the outlets are now being monitored. There's just a handful left to install. We are on track to have those all installed by the end of this fiscal year. And then the blue and green dots that you see scattered in the watersheds kind of throughout the state are the locations of those intensive watershed monitoring sites, those 5,000 stream sites that we're looking to monitor over that 10-year cycle. And those will be sampled once every 10 years to allow us to assess water quality through a combination of biological, physical, and chemical monitoring. One thing to note is, again, that increasing level of effort and then that local and citizen monitoring are key. You can see a little bit of that on the stream monitoring. It'll be more evident when we get to the lake monitoring as well. And that's this next slide, which shows our monitoring progress for lakes. Again, the graph on the left shows how the monitoring effort has increased as far as the number of sites, or in this case, the number of lakes that are being monitored each year. And you can see that increase that is correlated with the passage of the Legacy Act and the additional resources that were provided. And in this case, you can see that the yellow bars, they look kind of clear, actually, on the screen, is the citizen and local monitoring that's being done on lakes across Minnesota. And that's with pass-through funding that's provided by the Pollution Control Agency to local units of government and local nonprofit organizations to do lake monitoring. So again, the Pollution Control Agency is focused on monitoring and assessing lakes that are 500 acres and larger, and then we're encouraging the local and volunteer monitoring of the smaller lakes. And the map on the right then shows the locations of the lake monitoring that's underway or planned for next spring. The PCA sites are in blue, or the darker dot, and then the citizen and local monitoring is in yellow. And you can again see that large component of citizen and local monitoring that makes up our lake monitoring. Another thing to note is that we're just getting ready to publish the request for proposals for this year's, so fiscal year 2009's round of surface water assessment grants to local units of government and to nonprofits for citizen monitoring. So we really expect that over the next few months, the number of yellow dots is going to significantly increase as that RFP is published and proposals come back in and are awarded. Well, rather than focusing just on lakes and streams as kind of individual water bodies, we do want to recognize that both lakes and streams are part of a watershed. And to get a good picture of what's going on with water quality, we need to understand what's happening within those watersheds to those lakes and streams and how they affect each other. So with the Clean Water Legacy Act monitoring, what we're really moving towards is integrating our lake and stream monitoring to provide a better understanding of the water quality in each of the state's major watersheds. We've developed a schedule for monitoring the lakes and streams in each watershed on that 10-year cycle, and the slide here shows our progress with that monitoring. So you can see the progress through fiscal year 2009 and then the anticipated level of effort needed in fiscal years 10 and 11 in order to meet that goal of monitoring all of the watersheds on a 10-year cycle. And ultimately then, what we've learned from this monitoring effort is which waters are in good condition or meeting water quality standards and which waters are impaired or aren't meeting water quality standards. And these maps here give you a snapshot of which waters have been monitored for at least one water quality standard and the results that we have so far. So the waters on the left were found to meet the standard or standards for which they were monitored. The waters on the right were found to be not meeting or impaired for at least one standard. And the difference in color is the brown colored waters are ones that were impaired for one of the toxic pollutants, so mercury or PCBs. And then the red includes the conventional pollutants, which are things like bacteria or dissolved oxygen or excess nutrients in our lakes. So again, the focus for the good quality waters, the waters on the left, is to protect that water quality so they maintain those uses and don't get into that impaired category. And then for the waters that are impaired, the focus is on restoring that water quality so that those uses are met and the standards are restored. And on the 2008 impaired waters list, there are 2,575 impairments of Minnesota waters. And of those, 1,475 of them still need to be addressed by a total maximum daily load study to figure out where the pollutants are coming from and then what reductions are needed in order to restore that water quality. So now what I'd like to do is actually turn the presentation over to Glenn, who will update you on the progress we're making towards addressing those impaired waters.
Ms. Lothammer, let me just make sure. I don't know if I heard you correctly. Or missed this or not, but of all the total surface waters that will be assessed, the number that I've been repeating over and over for a couple of years is that something like 16 or 17% have been assessed.
Right.
What is that still the correct number?
It is still the correct number. It's about 14% of streams and about 18% of lakes. And because we go through the formal assessment process every 2 years on that EPA cycle, we're still working on those percentages for the official percentages, but that's based on the data that was collected through 2006. So for the 2008 impaired waters list, because of the public process part of it and the analysis that goes into it, we're always working about 2 years behind as far as the data that we have. So we've been collecting data since then. So I fully expect that those percentages are going to be much higher for the 2010 list, but those are based on the 2008 impaired waters list, that 14 and 18.
So the chart that shows where, well, okay, there's two different numbers. You know, one is the watershed testing and one is the specific stream and lake testing. And I'm not, that number you're talking about is the stream and lake testing, correct?
Right.
Not the watershed?
Correct.
So if you stay on a 10-year plan, where do you expect that to be in 2 years and then two more years?
Sure. We expect to see about a 10% increase. Well, about a 20% increase then every 2 years. Now, one of the challenges of that 14% and that 18% is that's based on all of the waters of the state, so all of the lakes 10 acres and larger, and all of the 105,000 miles of streams. And we're not going to monitor every single lake or every single stream mile. So if we use that as kind of the basis for the monitoring, we're never going to get to 100% because we need to prioritize where that activity goes. We can't get to all of the lakes and things like that. That's part of the reason for taking more of that watershed approach. That gives a better picture of how we're doing as far as monitoring our waters and understanding what's happening on the landscape is to report that information by watersheds, and we will get to 100% of our watersheds that have been monitored and assessed and understood.
Okay, and then do you know what percent of the other waters, the individual lakes and rivers and streams, you will get to in 10 years approximately? Over 10 acres?
Sure.
10 acres in winter.
You know, we haven't actually calculated that out. We have that for the lakes greater than 500 acres because the goal is to get to all of those, but we could certainly do that and provide that to the committee.
Did I see some other hands? Yes. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lotheimer, I wanted to follow up on the auto sampling stations that you've installed. And just what's the cost per unit of those?
I'm not sure what the cost is for the actual flow monitoring because that is being done by the Department of Natural Resources with funding that they received under the Clean Water Legacy Act. As far as the way that kind of the division of work is the Department of Natural Resources is installing the automatic flow monitoring stations, and then the Pollution Control Agency is collecting the samples and having it analyzed for chemistry. As far as the chemistry samples are concerned, it works out to be about $3,000 to $3,500 a station for the analysis and equipment upkeep as far as, you know, being able to take grab samples and things like that.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. And last time we had a significant budget shortfall. I think I'm familiar with other agencies that had auto sampling stations that they shut those down or... So I'm wondering, and maybe the DNR can answer this, but just how permanent these, when we invest into these auto sampling stations, you know, you have to have the folks that go out there and pick up the data or analyze the data, and I'm wondering how permanent they are in case we run into budget difficulties.
Well, and from our perspective, you know, we do need the people are going out and actually taking the samples, but they may be able to give you a better answer as far as how long the stations are good for, how often they need to be replaced.
All right. Was there any other questions? Representative Virginia.
Thank you. On the stream monitoring, you mentioned that you were, and let me just see if I understand this correctly, that you were doing three types of analysis, biological, chemical, and physical, and so that will be done for each stream, and so you have measures of health that meet each one of these. Is that what I'm getting?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, yes, that's correct. We have a nested design so that at all of the stations we'll be collecting chemistry information and biological information and also the physical information about habitat and things like that. And then as you get into the larger streams, we collect that chemistry data more often. But yes, those all three components are collected.
Yes, thank you. Here's one of my concerns. With we're doing all of this work based on the Clean Water Act, which was done in the 70s, when folks didn't understand which pollutants, or they understood the pollutants of that time. Since then, we've understood that there are other things that are also impacting our waters. does your monitoring, will your monitoring of the streams actually present a good picture to Minnesotans, or will folks come back and say, but you know what, you ignored this, and so it's not telling us really what's going on? Are we going to get that feedback?
Madam Chair, Representative Lagunias, yes, we will, and I think the key part of that is the biological information, because the fish community and the invertebrate community are really an integrator of what's happening with the chemistry and also the physical environment. And so what happens is we sample that biological community, compare that to reference sites that are unimpacted, and see how a particular site compares. And if there's problems, then we need to follow up and figure out what's causing the problem, what's the stressor that's impacting the biology. The biology really does a nice job of integrating across types of pollutants and integrating across time as well.
So what are you finding with the biological monitoring? I mean, just in general.
Madam Chair, Representative Lagunias, that's a difficult question to answer kind of in general, because it is so site-specific. We are actually just getting the data back from the monitoring that was started with the Clean Water Legacy Act. We get the fish data back right away, and then it takes a little bit of time to get the invertebrate data back. So we're starting to put together the reports and the information for each watershed. So I don't really have a general answer to that question, because it varies from watershed to watershed.
And let me ask then, in terms of the assessments that you're doing, how are we doing? Are we still at about 40%? I know you said the data isn't all in yet, mm-hmm. but does it look like we're at about the same level of impairment when you reach out to additional waters?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do think that we're still about at that 40%, and that's based on monitoring that we do that's on a random basis. So the sites are selected randomly across the state, so they can be considered representative, just like a poll is representative of the larger population. These sites are representative of kind of the state as a whole. So in general, we're at about that 40%. That's going to vary depending on where you are in the state. And this watershed monitoring will allow us to get a better sense of that over time.
Do you see any trends, though, of change for the better or for worse at this point?
As far as trends, it's still a little too soon to tell. That's where the cycle comes in, of being able to come back and revisit the sites and see how changes have occurred over time. So.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Scuda.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Glenn Scuda with the Pollution Control Agency, manager in the watershed section. So given the impairments that have been found on the right-hand map that's displayed, the next step is then to identify what's causing problems in those waters, what's causing them to be polluted, and figure out how to clean them up. So the studies that we do then to accomplish that are called TMDLs, which stands for Total Maximum Daily Loads. That's Clean Water Act terminology. Since we know that the water body is impaired, we know that it's receiving too much pollution. The TMDL study determines what the limit of pollution the water can tolerate is, and where in the watershed that pollution is coming from, and then limits the amount that can come from all the different sources in the watershed. So some of the typical pollutants thus far that have been addressed by TMDLs include bacteria and turbidity, or the cloudiness of water in streams, and then phosphorus levels in lakes, which grows the algae and turns lakes green. Also, TMDLs are done for waters with conditions that indicate poor water quality, like streams with low dissolved oxygen or with impaired fish and invertebrate communities, like Shannon was just talking about. Minnesota is also one of the few states to have done a statewide mercury TMDL that addresses about 1,000 mercury impairments in Minnesota. So one way of thinking about doing a TMDL is that if the current amount of pollution entering an impaired water from its watershed is the pie on the left-hand side, we need to shrink the size of that pie, or decrease the amount of pollution coming into that water body as shown on the right. And the pie on the left shows how the study determines how much pollution is coming from all the different sources in the watershed. WLA stands for waste load allocation, and that's pollution coming from all the permitted sources, for example, wastewater treatment plants, or permitted city stormwater systems for larger cities or communities. LAs are load allocations, and that's pollution coming from non-regulated sources like row crop agriculture or stormwater from smaller cities that are not under permits. Any natural contributions of pollution that there might be are also included in that load allocation portion. The study then determines the maximum pollutant load that the water body can handle and still remain in attainment of water quality standards, and the size of the pie is then shrunk down like on the right side. The maximum loading of the pollutant must then be divided up among all the sources of the pollutant in the watershed, which calls for reductions in pollution to fit into that smaller pie. A margin of safety is also included to account for scientific uncertainties in the study that we do, and also as a buffer so that waters don't just teeter on the edge of impairment or quickly or easily become impaired again once they meet standards. There's also reserve capacity that can be set aside to allow for future growth and any accompanying increases in pollution discharge that could occur where growth is anticipated in a given watershed. TMDL studies are primarily locally led and done in cooperation with other state agencies and other water resource managers, and strives for significant public participation. The PCA is responsible for submitting the TMDL studies to the US EPA, and US EPA is the final approval authority of the TMDLs. Studies are complicated scientific and social processes and take an average of about 3 years to do. They can be significantly shorter if there's been past study and work done. They can be longer if they're highly complex or geographically large or controversial. Once the TMDL study is complete, then an implementation plan is put together to guide restoration of the water body. Oftentimes that implementation plan is done pretty much concurrently with the TMDL study. So the ultimate goal remains to return the water bodies to meeting water quality standards. This chart shows progress in conducting TMDL studies and the great increase in additional studies that we are able to have underway and that we're completing with the additional Clean Water Legacy Act funding that began in FY07 and particularly really increasing in 2008 at the start of this biennium. And the last two bars for fiscal years 10 and 11 are projections at the same level of effort that we've had since passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act. And these are cumulative numbers over time of TMDL projects that are either completed or underway. Many TMDL projects do address multiple listed impaired waters at one time. So the number of actual impaired waters listings that are being addressed by these TMDLs, you could take those numbers and multiply them by about five in terms of the number of impairments actually being addressed. This map helps give you a visual picture of the geography, shows where the current TMDL projects are underway for conventional pollutants, the types that I mentioned earlier, not the toxic pollutants like mercury or PCBs. They are underway all over the state, utilizing local expertise all over the state. And they're also helping to build local capacity for doing watershed work all over the state where those studies are being done. Some projects are not locally led, and the PCA takes the lead on those, as that is our responsibility and mandate under the Federal Clean Water Act and State Clean Water Legacy Act. In some cases, it's because the geographic scope of the project is too big, like the Lake Pepin TMDL, for example, that covers about two-thirds of the state in terms of the watershed draining to Lake Pepin. Some TMDLs are multi-jurisdictional, interstate, or even international, and the state is the appropriate lead in some of those cases. And in other cases, the local capacity or interest in conducting the TMDL study is low, so the PCA takes leadership then too. But we still keep local parties involved and do as much public participation as possible. Most projects, as you can see, are underway in the south and in the metro area, due largely to the fact of we do have more identified impairments in those parts of the state, as well as good local capacity that has been underway from efforts in the Minnesota River Basin with watershed districts and watershed management organizations in the metro area. This next map shows where we have completed TMDL projects thus far that have been approved by US EPA. And we have completed 17 projects that address 105 impairment listings at this point. And many of these projects have received Clean Water Legacy Act implementation funding as well, and implementation is underway. We have about 15 projects addressing about 70 or more impairments that we will have completed by early calendar 2009. And while the magnitude of this problem of all these impairments, the amount of work that has to be done is somewhat daunting, it's good to know that past watershed work that we were doing before we really ramped up the TMDL work has already resulted in some success of returning 9 water bodies to meeting water quality standards based on work that was done in the watersheds to try to clean up these impaired waters. These waters have been delisted or removed from the impaired waters list within the last 6 years. And these were restorations that involved watershed activities like improvements to septic systems, feedlots, wastewater treatment plants, and stormwater systems, depending on the specific impairment and conditions that were affecting the impaired waters.
Mr. Scuda, I'm just going to interrupt for a second. On the page, let's see a number, the one that lists the impairments that you just went through, on some of them it says, you know, 7 impairments, 10 impairments, or 1 impairment. What does that mean? Impaired for different things, or what does that mean?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, it can be sometimes the same water body is impaired for multiple pollutants. Mm-hmm. It also can mean that we address multiple water bodies in one study. So, for example, the Lower Cannon River Turbidity TMDL addressed 2 impairments on 2 different stretches of the Lower Cannon River. The Pipestone Creek TMDL, for example, addressed impairments for fecal coliform and turbidity, 3 impairments for each of those pollutants on 3 separate water bodies in that area. So we're trying to be as efficient as we can, addressing multiple impairments, multiple stream segments or lake segments of lakes that are impaired at one time. But the conditions of the watershed, the impairments that are known, kind of limits us a little bit in that fact. But Shannon will also talk shortly about how we're looking at trying to get more of our study done on a complete watershed basis as well, so we can be addressing all impairments in a given watershed at one time. One last thing for me to mention, just in terms of implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act, is that the Act called for the formation of a Clean Water Council, group made up of all the representative organizations and government entities at multiple levels that are involved in water resource management. And the council has been together for a year and a half now. They began meeting in March of 2007. And per the Act, they are developing strategies for civic engagement, prioritization of how the Clean Water Legacy Act work should be done, for monitoring assessment, for the TMDL study, for the implementation. Also protection and monitoring efforts, and then effectiveness measures and research needs for the program. They've got 4 subcommittees set up that are addressing these particular areas at this time. And they have a report due to the legislature, which will be coming to you in about 3 months, with details on what their recommendations are, what their findings are for further implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act from here out. With that, if there are no questions, I'll pass it back to Ms. Lothammer.
Okay, thank you. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a small question. When I look at the corrected impairments, and we're looking at, for instance, said impairments that were caused by septic systems, stormwater treatment plants, feedlots, et cetera. And then earlier in your presentation, you mentioned the row crop egg problem, which is putting nutrients and phosphorus into the waters. What type of corrections do you do for that? I mean, do we go into the ditch buffer system, or how do we correct that problem, which, if not corrected, will just continue to exacerbate the problem?
Madam Chair, Representative, We have not, as you, if you find print on the map, we have not addressed or fixed any impairments where row crop agriculture was identified as the source. But we certainly are working in a lot of watersheds with producers with row crop agriculture, and there's quite a suite of agricultural best management practices that farmers have been moving to and implementing for years and are continuing to do so. So it's a kind of a long list, but it can be changes in tillage, it can be buffering ditches and water courses, pesticide and fertilizer management. It's a very long list of things that farmers are doing to help improve water quality. As we get more TMDLs completed, there will be some that will be calling for row crop agriculture reductions, and that's where the implementation dollars from the Clean Water Legacy Act, from the Federal Farm Bill, primarily Federal Farm Bill sources, will be used to implement those agricultural best management practices.
Mr. Scooter, just remind us, how does it work, or remind me at least, once a TMDL is adopted by the PCA, I guess, how does the implementation work? If it requires behavioral changes by different, you know, permitted entities or non-point entities in the watershed, how does that happen? Does that have to be adopted by the local governments across the watershed by law? I mean, does our law, state or federal law, require that to happen?
Yes, Madam Chair. The TMDLs do not give us, give the state or the federal government any additional regulatory authority than it already has. It sets out the pollution reductions that are needed. And where we do have regulatory authority, for example, with permits for wastewater treatment plants, we can then call for the required reductions from a wastewater treatment plant in that treatment plant permit per the TMDL. Where we don't have the regulatory authority, the TMDL sets the goal, calls for that reduction, but it cannot force it, cannot require it. Local entities could pass ordinances if it's within their purview, within their jurisdiction to do so, to control certain sources. That would be an option. Otherwise, it is largely incentive-based, where we call for the reduction and means to accomplish that reduction, and then give the incentives, financial, educational, otherwise, to make those implementation actions happen. But the TMDL does not give us additional regulatory authority.
But is there any kind of enforcement mechanism if a TMDL is set, but it's not being met? What is the recourse? I mean, a citizen could they bring a lawsuit based on the federal Clean Water Law? Or how does that work?
I think that's potentially possible. Again, where there are the permits and the requirements, we can force those. If those aren't being met, we could, you know, we could take regulatory action, or someone could bring a suit.
But in a non-point, those are trickier.
Right. We've not seen anyone bring a lawsuit in that scenario in Minnesota. I'm not sure nationally if that's also been done or not. But without the actual regulatory authority, it would be a complicated lawsuit to bring or to prove or to force a change where there isn't an existing authority there.
Well, obviously the legislature could take that issue up if we chose to as well. I just have another question also. When you go back to your map of impaired waters, your blue and your brown map, and how can a citizen access this information easily? I mean, if you just want to pick any lake in Minnesota and know if it's impaired or unimpaired, what's the best way to do that?
Madam Chair, I'll answer that question. Basically, there's a couple different ways that a citizen could get that information. They can go to the Pollution Control Agency's website, and on the Impaired Waters page, we actually have the spreadsheets with the lists of the individually identified waters that are impaired. Probably an easier way to get to that information is from our Environmental Data Access webpage, which is basically the window into our monitoring data. There's two parts to that part of the website. There's the monitoring data part, and then there is a part that's focused on impaired waters. And so a citizen could actually do a map-based search through that window to identify what the status is of the water that they're interested in. Is it impaired? Is it unimpaired? Has it not been monitored yet?
And then do those link up? I know the DNR has websites about water quality on a number of lakes, too, but do those link up to each other?
Yes, Madam Chair, they do. Yep. So somebody coming in through Lake Finder, for example, on the DNR side can get access to that information.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to the Clean Water Council. When we established the council, there was a provision that was established that said that no lobbyists could serve on the council, and there was some concern on about that provision. And I'm just asking, has that prohibition inhibited any way the functioning of the Clean Water Council?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't believe that's been the case. I think it's very upfront, may have slowed a little bit the nomination process, but you know the council's been operating for a year and a half now, functioning quite well. So I don't believe that's been a problem.
All right. Did you have further testimony then, Ms. Lothammer?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just a couple more slides. Basically, what we wanted to do is highlight a couple key next steps for our TMDL efforts under the Clean Water Legacy Act. First, as Glenn had mentioned, the first is a framework that we're moving towards to better address protection and restoration under the Legacy Act. Basically, I already noted how we are organizing our monitoring by watersheds and moving towards integrating our lake and our stream monitoring to get a better picture of that overall watershed health. We're also looking to carry that organizational approach forward into our TMDL and protection strategy development and also our implementation activities to better meet the coordination and collaboration needs associated with the Clean Water Legacy Act and the impaired waters process. So the overall goal is to move from an individual impairment-driven approach to a more integrated, efficient system. As Glenn had mentioned, we're already making strides towards that by doing multi-pollutant or multi-stream segment TMDLs. And this is an effort to move even farther in that direction and look at a watershed as a whole and try to address the impairments all at once rather than kind of doing a few now and a few years from now. This watershed framework would then provide a richer understanding of our water quality conditions, and it also would better engage local government, stakeholders, and citizens in the process. And then finally, we're also working with the University of Minnesota and other state agencies to develop an interagency approach to track our effectiveness in implementing the Legacy Act and addressing impaired waters. And right now, all of the various state agencies and organizations have measures for our individual agency responsibilities, but we really recognize the need to develop a shared tracking and reporting strategy to convey the overall effectiveness of the Clean Water Legacy Act and the state agencies across multiple state agencies and then the multiple programs that are involved in this implementation effort. Therefore, we've been working with the University of Minnesota, acting as a facilitator and a convener for this effort to develop a framework for this tracking approach. We've identified kind of the general framework with key elements ranging from organizational performance type measures to the environmental outcomes, social indicators, and measures of partnership and leveraging, so working with other stakeholders and local groups. And this fall, we'll be populating the framework with our specific agency measures so that we can start to do that more coordinated reporting and tracking effort. We're also working on the data management system needed in order to implement this effectiveness tracking approach as coordinated across the agency. And with that, then, that concludes our update on the impaired waters and our progress implementing the Clean Water Legacy Act, and we'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you may have.
All right, thank you. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lothammer, you had a slide here that's titled TMDL Project Ramp-Up Due to CWLA Funding. You had to make some assumptions as to how much funding you would be receiving in the future. May or may not be there. Have you tried to look ahead to see what would happen to this schedule and also implementation if the constitutional amendment would pass and you'd pretty much be guaranteed up to about $90 million a year for conducting compliance with the Clean Water Legacy Act?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, you know, we haven't made any assumptions about what funding may come or may not come. What the graphs that you see are doing is basically identifying the level of effort that would be needed to continue on the path of monitoring and assessing our waters on a 10-year cycle, and then addressing the impairments that are identified through that process. So that's what those graphs represent.
So, Manager, if there's improved funding, if there's better funding, this might be accelerated. If the funding is not there, we would not be able to meet the 10-year cycle. Is that a safe assumption?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I think that's a reasonable assumption that you know the additional funding that we received has allowed us to accelerate our efforts.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lauterman, does this map then correlate roughly with the graph that Senator Fredrickson was just talking about? This is the amount of work that will be accomplished?
Ms. Lauterman?
Madam Chair and Senator, the graph that you're referring to is showing how we're stepping through the watersheds, and then what we do have to make some assumptions about how many impairments we would anticipate finding within those watersheds. And so they're related, but they're not kind of matching A to A and B to B, basically, because of some of those assumptions that go into planning for how many impairments we might need to address.
Senator Rummel?
So at this pace, do we have any sense of when we can do a relatively statewide assessment of watersheds?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes, at this pace, we're on pace to cycle through all of our watersheds on a 10-year cycle. So we're doing 10% of the watersheds each year.
And Senator Rummel, just to remind you, we put that 10% a year benchmark into our budget bill a couple of years ago, along with the additional funding that we gave the state agencies, and said we want to make sure that we're getting, you know, we have a 10-year goal and that we're getting 10% of the way there each year so that we can measure success and make sure we're on target for achieving those goals.
So there's more that has been accomplished than this? That's what I find confusing.
That doesn't look like it's enough.
No.
But
that doesn't look like 10% to me. Or a 10-year goal of 10% each year. I mean, so have some of these other places that are white been monitored? Will they be monitored in the next 10 years? That's my question.
So do you expect the whole map to be covered
yes.
in 10 years, is what you're asking,
yes.
which is what we just said we're going to do. Ms. Lothammer.
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, that's correct. What that graph shows is just the first 3 years. It doesn't show the full 10-year schedule, but after 10 years, that whole state map would be covered with colors.
With the watershed assessment.
With the watershed assessment, right.
But the individual lake and stream assessments, they said they're not going to do 100% of those, but they'll do a representative. I don't know exactly. I would like to get an idea of what you know, out of those 12,000 lakes or 10,000 lakes, whichever number you're looking at, what percent you think would be mm-hmm. covered in a 10-year period.
And Madam Chair, we can do that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Representative Virginia?
Yes, I think it would be helpful if we had a statistic that showed us how much acreage you were going to cover in the aggregate compared to how much acreage there is out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to get our hands around mm-hmm. this just using the numbers that you're using. We can't get the picture. So if you could help us out with that, both in stream and mm-hmm. in lake acreage, so for the future, if you could do that. My question to you is, as we're going forward, what problems do you anticipate?
Ms. Lathammer.
Madam Chair and Representative Lagunas, problems in general as far as kind of monitoring and assessments, or is just
any of the problems, what are the big problems that you see going forward?
Well, I think some of the problems or challenges that we have are, you know, the wealth of water resources that we have. So making sure that we're targeting the lakes and the streams that are most critical to that watershed health. And we're always developing new tools for doing that and better ways to be able to accomplish that. I also think, you know, a big part of our strategy relies on that local engagement and local involvement. And we've seen a lot of partners that have stepped up and been willing to, for example, monitor their lakes and streams or get involved in a TMDL. we're always looking for ways to better enhance that partnership, because it does rely on that local engagement, both for the planning phase and for developing the TMDL, and then also for the implementation. And one of the reasons why we're really interested in moving forward this watershed framework is because we feel that it could help us better engage at that local level, you know, provide more predictability as to when TMDLs or protection efforts are going to get started, and then help us able allow us to better identify those local partners early in the process, get them involved with monitoring, so that they can also participate in the planning and then the cleanup work as well. So that will be a big challenge, but we're seeing some good progress with that.
Well, along those same lines, you know, where you listed 17 approved TMDL projects, and by approved, that means you've set a standard, right? It doesn't mean that they've been achieved. And so how many of these are realistic, do you think, in terms of are there enough local changes being made to meet these TMDLs in most of these areas, do you think?
Madam Chair, that part of the process is identifying what the goal is through that TMDL. You know, we have the water quality standard, which is the ultimate goal, but then setting those interim goals and those kind of those stretch goals to be able to achieve the standard. And the monitoring is a key component of that as well. You know, the idea of cycling through the watersheds on a 10-year cycle, that we don't just do the monitoring once and then we're done. We're collecting that additional information to be able to measure our progress towards those TMDLs. And if we aren't making adequate progress in achieving those water quality standards, making some changes. I mean, there will be opportunities then to reopen the TMDL, make adjustments if we're not seeing the kind of progress that we had anticipated at the outset.
Well, that's where I think the legislature is going to want to dig deeper as we move forward to make sure that once we get these plans in place, that they're happening, they're being implemented, and that, you know, see if local governments either need some nudges or some help or whatever it is, get the job done. Because if we set these great goals and they're not happening, then we're just spinning our wheels and spending a lot of money. Senator Frederickson.
And Chairman Slothammer. So I understand exactly what we're talking about here, kind of a follow-up to Senator Anderson's question. Approved TMDL, I assume, meant that the EPA had approved that TMDL?
That is correct.
Okay. That's a good clarification. Yeah. All right. Go ahead, please. Representative Jody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any crossover with this data for groundwater, for drinking water, or is it surface water only? And if it is, is there some point in the future where the relationship between those two will be explored?
Ms. Lothammer.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Clean Water Legacy Act is specifically focuses on surface water, so the monitoring that we're doing through this effort is focused on surface water. The Pollution Control Agency does also do groundwater monitoring as part of a cooperative effort, and we are seeing more interest from our watershed group in that groundwater data, too, because the groundwater is part of the picture, particularly in areas with more kind of porous soils where that water can move back and forth into streams or into lakes. So I would anticipate that we'll see more interest in that interaction as we move forward. And if you have, yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are studies that we have looked at the groundwater impact on surface water, for example, where, you know, for example, groundwater that has low oxygen levels is causing low oxygen levels in the stream. We need to account for that when we do a TMDL, so we're not looking for some phantom source of pollutant causing low dissolved oxygen in the water when it's really coming out of the groundwater. So we do assess that in TMDL studies where that is a potential stressor or cause.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to step back before the TMDLs to the impairments, and I think it's following up on Representative Wagenius's question about the future. Are we seeing any new impairments? I'm thinking of the PFC question with surface waters that are not tipping into impaired, or we're finding detections but are moving towards impairments, or any other compounds out there?
Ms. Lothammer.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, we the PFCs would be an example of types of pollutants that we maybe weren't on our horizon for kind of our routine monitoring that becomes or comes on our horizon because of other information that we learn. There certainly is the potential for that to happen in other situations. But we do have monitoring that's designed to try to get at that more in-depth understanding. In addition to the Legacy Act monitoring that we do, where we're trying to cover a lot of waters and get close to that 100% of our watersheds, we also do what we call probabilistic monitoring or random monitoring, where we pick a handful of sites, maybe 50 lakes or 50 stream sites. Because there's fewer sites, we can do a lot greater suite of pollutants and get a more in-depth look at the water quality. And looking at that over time, that will allow us to start to, I think, get a better picture of, are there certain pollutants that we're not routinely looking for that are starting to emerge as a potential area of concern. So that monitoring, I think, then can help feed into the more statewide surveys that we do for impaired water.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if maybe this question had been asked before I came in. How many waters in Minnesota have been assessed, and how many are left to be assessed? I mean, if you have numbers, that'd be great. Otherwise, percentage would be okay, too.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, basically, I have percentages. I don't have actual numbers with me, but about 14% of the streams and about 18% of the lakes have been assessed for the 2008 impaired waters list. Now, that's based on the data through 2006. Because we do the assessments every 2 years, we're always basically working 2 years in arrears because it takes that two-year period to do the analysis and go through the public input process. So we actually have data on more than those numbers, but we're just heading into now the assessment process for the 2010 list. So you'll see those numbers increase for 2010.
So, Madam Chair, give me, regardless of the year, how many so far have been assessed total since we started assessing, and how many are left?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, that's not a number that I have at my fingertips here, but it's certainly something we could provide to the committee.
I appreciate that. May I ask one last follow-up, Madam Chair? how many more waters were you able to assess with the extra funding that the legislature passed? I can't remember the exact amount.
The goal that we were just talking about, we set the goal of 10% a year for 10 years, but that's, everything up till from the passage of the Act till now is at that 14% or 16% level. And so they really, and that's over 2 years, I think you said. Anyway, go ahead. I'll let you answer it better than I can.
Madam Chair, the question was asked, I think, and answered. It did accelerate the assessment. By how much, I'm wondering.
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, if you look at the slide that's on the screen now, basically this is showing the number of stream sites that we can monitor on an annual basis. You can see up until fiscal year 2003, we were at about 100 sites per year. And even through 2006, because of LCCMR funding, we were up to 200 sites per year. So through 2006 would be the monitoring that's reflected on the current list, that current 14% of streams. And now we're at 2.5 times that at 500 sites per year of capacity, plus the additional monitoring that's being done by local citizens and local units of government with pass-through funding. So you can see the acceleration of the stream monitoring there. And then for the lake monitoring, the picture, you can see that we were able to monitor between 50 and 100 lakes per year up until the passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act and the additional resources. Now, this year, there's 475 lakes, I think, that are being monitored by local units of government. That's over 2 years, mm-hmm. and citizens, and then another 100 lakes being monitored by the PCA. So a very significant increase in the level of effort.
Madam Chair, will you refresh my memory on how much more we put in?
$30 million. Yeah, $30 million, and it's okay. In the beginning of the handout.
Okay.
And that's just the PCA portion, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. So a lot went to Bowser as well, and something in our.
Can we say then, Madam Chair, that $30 million doubled your efforts? Because you said that's twice as many.
Madam Chair and Senator Sabri, yeah, it at least doubled our efforts. Actually, probably more than doubled our efforts.
Okay. So one time $30 million doubled the efforts. An annual increase of $90 million would increase your effort by six times what you were doing prior to that $30 million. And this is in reference to the dedicated funding amendment, which would dedicate $90 million a year just to clean water efforts. Now, not all $90 million will necessarily go to assessment, but it seems to me, to Senator Fredrickson's question, that gives us a little bit of a clue as to what that amendment will do in terms of our impairment assessment. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Well, we just want to ask again for the follow-up information that we've requested. If we could get that sent to us, to the chairs, we can send it out to all the committee members, or you could just send it to everyone. That would be very helpful. Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we're going to move on pretty quickly to the second part of the hearing.
Oh, really?
Members, I think we're ready now.
Oh, I got no wonder.
Different genetics or what?
Members. I think we're ready now to hear from the legislative auditor. We appreciate your coming, and we will give you our full attention.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Cecile Ferkel, who is the deputy legislative auditor in charge of the Financial Audit Division. I also want to acknowledge behind me David Palacino, an audit manager who worked on a special review that we're going to be discussing today, and also Jerry Fodi, a staff auditor who assisted him. Well, Madam Chair and members, I think all of you recall that back in May, there was an article in the Star Tribune that was titled "Taxpayers Paid for Game Warden Meeting," and that really sparked a good deal of concern and controversy. And shortly thereafter, this joint committee met to discuss some of the issues involved, and I appeared before you and indicated that I thought that the issues and concerns from that article really required a review by the Office of the Legislative Auditor as well. We completed that and released the report last week, and many of you were there and heard our presentation then, and have since, I think, had an opportunity to review or at least read about or hear about our concerns and findings and recommendations. So I'll be quite brief in my presentation, and we will want to answer your more detailed questions. In the summer, in July of 2005, there was a delegation of DNR enforcement officers who attended a conference of the North American Wildlife Enforcement Officers Association and made a presentation that resulted in Minnesota being chosen to host the 2007 NOAA conference. And to formalize that, the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association signed a hosting agreement with NOAA to host that conference in Minnesota. There never was a formal agreement for the Department of Natural Resources to participate in the hosting of that conference. The only formal agreement that delineated the responsibilities and the opportunities, if you will, to host that conference were between the two private organizations, NOAA, which, as the name implies, is an organization of wildlife enforcement officers, some of whom are called conservation officers, game wardens, and various other things around the country, and also the organization includes the provinces of Canada as well. So it's an organization that promotes conservation. It is a private organization. And one of their main activities is to hold this annual conference somewhere in Canada or the United States. The Minnesota Conservation Officers Association, the other private organization that signed the agreement to host the conference in Minnesota in 2005, is a union.
a union that represents the Minnesota Conservation Officers that are employees of the Department of Natural Resources. So we basically had two private organizations enter into an agreement to host a conference. And after that occurred, the enforcement officers, the conservation officers in the enforcement division at DNR went to work, planning, working, and ultimately hosting the conference in St. Paul in 2007. And I think if you talk to many of them, they would probably say, at least before the article occurred and the controversy occurred, that it was, from their point of view, a successful conference. They would say they got training, they had a lot of enjoyable social activities, they made a lot of contacts with various other conservation officers from around the country and in Canada, and so they might ask, what is the problem? Well, the problem is that, as I said, there never was an agreement or an authorization for the state to participate in that conference, and yet, in the end, the state of Minnesota, through the Department of Natural Resources, spent approximately $400,000 to host that conference. And we think about $300,000 of that was inappropriate. So we agree that for DNR, for conservation officers, to participate in training and to spend some public money to achieve that is appropriate. In fact, we would encourage it. But a large part of this conference was really a family and social activity. It went on for many days, and only a small part of it was actually related to training of conservation officers. And as you know, conservation officers in Minnesota are licensed peace officers, and they need to get a certain amount of training. And from this conference, they got about 10.5 hours of training. But as I say, the conference went on for a long period of time, had many ancillary activities associated with it, and the Enforcement Division, conservation officers, and the Department of Natural Resources spent a lot of time, a lot of money planning and hosting those events as well as the training activities. That's the part that we find inappropriate. So that's one of our concerns, one of our findings, that about $300,000 of public money to the Department of Natural Resources was really inappropriately spent. One of our other concerns is that that occurred because we believe the department really never exercised necessary and appropriate control over what was occurring. We think that there were opportunities, certainly, for the department, specifically in the commissioner's office, but in other aspects of the department, in the business office, to exercise better control over the state's participation. We reference in the report, for example, that shortly after the agreement was signed for the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association to host the conference in Minnesota, Commissioner Merriam was alerted. Commissioner Gene Merriam was Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources at the time. He was alerted to the fact that the NAWEA conference was coming to Minnesota, and he was asked how the state would participate, and specifically, would the state, would DNR, be a sponsor of the conference? And we quote his testimony, which he gave to us under oath, and he said no. He thought it would be inappropriate for public money to sponsor a conference of a private organization. And yet, as I said, over $400,000 of DNR money ended up being spent on this conference. That was, when Commissioner Merriam was told about this, an opportunity, we think, for the department to step back and clearly delineate in writing, define how it was going to participate, the limitations on that participation. For example, Commissioner Merriam said he thought it would be fine for conservation officers to attend the conference and for the department to pay for their registration so that they could achieve the training that the conference was offering and which the conservation officers needed. So at that point in time, Commissioner Merriam delineated a degree to which the department would participate, and it would be appropriate for public money to be spent. But that decision on the part of Commissioner Merriam was very informally communicated to the director of the Enforcement Division, basically a hallway conversation to say to Colonel Mike Ham, Commissioner Merriam says the department is not going to sponsor the conference. There were other opportunities on an ad hoc basis
for the department to take a situation, step back, and define exactly how much money the department was willing to commit, how much time, exactly how the department was going to participate in this conference. That never occurred. And so you had not only informal communication, but you also had mixed messages. As we interviewed people from former Commissioner Merriam to current assistant deputy commissioners within the department, as the situation developed, they seemed to have very different ideas about exactly what the department's role was. And as I say, even though there was a formal written document that defined and delineated how the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association was going to participate and what its responsibilities were going to be, no one in the department ever developed a written document, a budget, or any other kind of document that defined how the department was going to participate. And so we think the end result was, by a variety of means, the department ended up putting in over $400,000 of public resources. A significant amount of that money, we think, was spent inappropriately. The other concern we have is that in addition to the public money that was used to support the conference, conservation officers went out and solicited money from private sources, from businesses, some of whom do business with the state of Minnesota, such as Cabela's. Conservation officers went out and asked these private businesses to put up money from private sources to support this conference. This was by design. The hosting agreement that I've referred to several times between NOEA and the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association specifically said that fundraising from private sources would occur, and that would be a responsibility of the host, the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. And that as a result of this fundraising, that NOEA and the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association would achieve a profit from hosting this conference. And again, they achieved that. They achieved it from the fundraising that they did, but they also achieved it because the state covered most of the costs. We think that that fundraising was inappropriate. We also think it was a conflict with state law, which defines conflicts of interest. And we refer to that in the report. We think it was inappropriate, and the Department of Natural Resources should have told conservation officers clearly that it was inappropriate to use state time, their position, to go out and fundraise for this conference if the purpose was to benefit this private organization, or actually both private organizations, because both NOEA and the Minnesota Conservation Officers achieved a profit from sponsoring this conference. So very briefly, Madam Chair, that's a quick overview of our three major concerns. We have a fourth finding related to the department not fully following some travel regulations, but I think our main concerns really are that the department never controlled its involvement in this conference, public money was inappropriately spent, and state positions and resources were inappropriately used to raise money from private sources. So with that, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to answer your questions.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Mr. Nobles, at the Audit Commission meeting last week, there was some conflicting information provided about where exactly the Minnesota Conservation Officers contact information was. Was that at the Department of Natural Resources on the letterhead? Could you clarify or maybe provide some examples of on that issue?
Yes, Representative Hansen. One of the concerns that we had throughout our special review was the very close relationship that exists between the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association, the Enforcement Division, which is a division, as you well know, within the Department of Natural Resources. We believe that because the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association is a private organization, a union, that there really should be a line that separates the two organizations, the Enforcement Division and the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. And yet, throughout our special review, we saw that these two organizations are really inseparable. They're indistinguishable from one another in many respects. I think that the comment that Representative Hansen referred to is that one of the members that attended the Legislative Audit Commission hearing said that, in fact, that the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association does have its own phone number and mailing address and other resources. We didn't find that to be true as a part of our special review. In fact, I would refer you, and I think this is what Representative Hansen is referring to, the fundraising letter that was approved by the Commissioner's Office for fundraising from private sources for this conference. When the draft was originally presented, it was presented on a Department of Natural Resources letterhead, as you can see. And the draft was reviewed in the Commissioner's Office, specifically by Assistant Commissioner Brad Moore. And he felt that it would be more appropriate for the letterhead to be from the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. Again, I think at that point it introduced a bit of confusion as to who's doing the fundraising and for what purpose. The letter, the text of the letter, refers to, again, both the department and the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association co-hosting this conference and, in a sense, being joined together as partners in this fundraising. Public organization and a private organization. And to use the resources of the state to do that. But for whatever reason, Assistant Commissioner Brad Moore said he thought it would be more appropriate that the fundraising letter, which was going to solicit funds from private sources, go out on the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association letterhead. So somebody went back to their office, got on their computer, I assume a state computer, and changed the letterhead to read Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. But that's all that changed. The address didn't change. Still a DNR address. The phone number didn't change. Still a DNR phone number. And the letter was signed not only by the president of the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association, but the director of the Enforcement Division, the Chief Conservation Officer, Mike Hamm, Colonel Mike Hamm, with the approval of the Commissioner's Office. So that's why we made the statement we did, that you see this really indistinguishable role being played between the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association and the Enforcement Division. As I think all of you know, all of the members of the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association are DNR employees. They're conservation officers. They're DNR employees. They're state employees. That's fine. But we think, again, they need to draw a line between when they are acting for the interests of their private organization, which is a union, and often is in conflict with the department. They do fight grievances against the department. There ought to be a line that's drawn between when these conservation officers are operating in the interests of their private organization and when they're operating as state employees. And again, for fundraising purposes, that was never done. In fact, we think the department really facilitated, in many ways, some confusion as to whether or not this was a partnership, whether it was both the state doing the fundraising, or whether it was just the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. I'd point to one other thing that we referenced in the report that I think exemplifies this confusion. When one of the conservation officers submitted a request for reimbursement for expenses that he had incurred for fundraising activities, he was told, no, the department will not cover those expenses because those should not be public expenses. Those should be the expenses of the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. again, a lot of confusion. How is it that the state can delegate its authority, which is in law for the commissioner to exercise this authority? How could it have delegated that to the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association? We're not clear on that, but the state did not itself use its authority for fundraising. It authorized this letter, but never after this letter was authorized, really exercised any control as a state agency over the fundraising that was to occur. The goods and services, the money that resulted from the fundraising, did not go into the state account. It went into an account controlled by the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. The goods that were donated, people that donated those goods were given a receipt from a private foundation that was established by the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. So you look at all the evidence and you're confused. Who's doing what? Is it the state that's doing the fundraising, or is it a private organization? And who's supposed to benefit from it? That's our concern.
Do you have a follow-up?
And that's one. I mean, is it clearly illegal to solicit funds to go for the state to solicit funds to go to a private organization? Is it clear in that letter when the funds are being solicited who those funds are going to go to?
Madam Chair, I believe that not only from this letter, but from slide presentations that were made and from the testimony that we received from people, that the impression was given to the businesses that were being solicited that the money was solely to support the conservation officers' training activities. And in fact, there was a representation in the letter that many of these conservation officers would be coming to this training on their own money, and therefore this solicitation of private funds was being done so that the registration fees could be subsidized in a sense. In fact, as you know from the report, it was the state that subsidized the registration fees so that additional money could go into supporting the conference. So we don't see that the fundraising had the result that was at least implied. But I do think people who were solicited had the impression that this money was going to be used solely for training. We believe that, again, by design, not by accident, but by the design of the hosting agreement itself between NOAA and the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association, the fundraising was in large part to ensure that the two private organizations would achieve a profit at the end of the conference.
To follow up on this, I was taken in your report by the statement that this fundraising, some of the fundraising, not by letter, but was actually done by presentation by officers in uniform on state time. Did you know how much of that was done?
Madam Chair, we don't know every incident. We know from the testimony of Captain Ham, for example, and we have a slide presentation that she made, and she acknowledged that she and the officers with her were in uniform when they made that presentation to Cabela's. I just want to add, though, Madam Chair, and I know this is a delicate and quite serious balancing of who is culpable here. And as I think all of you know, Colonel Ham and Captain Ham are both on paid leave by act of the commissioner because of this controversy. And I would also add that when the Office of the Legislative Auditor gets involved in an investigation, we often focus on the alleged improprieties of individuals. And so it was very possible within our jurisdiction and our experience that we would have focused only on Captain Ham or Colonel Ham in some of the activities where it's alleged they may have violated 43A.38, the the law that defines conflicts of interest, which we think, in fact, was violated in the fundraising activities. You could focus on other individual activities of Colonel Ham, directives he was given that he may not have followed. And you might ask, in that regard, why did we not hold those individual officers culpable and responsible for those acts? I think we did not, because we found so many fingerprints on this conference, and many are those beyond the enforcement division, where there was not only tacit approval, but explicit approval of some of the activities. Now, can you point to instances where people in the department, the commissioner and others, said no, it would be inappropriate for us to do that? Yes, I've already referred to some of those instances where Commissioner Jean Merriam said, no, we're not going to be a sponsor. Or a person in the business office said, no, we're not going to pay the reimbursement expense for an officer who went out and engaged in fundraising. But we found these to be individual, somewhat isolated, and informally communicated directives. What we think should have occurred on those occasions is, as I said before, somebody in the department should have stepped back and said, what's going on here? We seem to be involved in a way that we haven't authorized. That's point one. But point two is that you have evidence that the department actually did approve money for this conference. Although Commissioner Merriam said he didn't want the department to be a sponsor, the department approved special expenses for the conference of considerable amount of money and approved a grant to the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association of $35,500 near the end of the planning phase of the conference, as it just about to occur, because it was concerned that they would not have enough money to cover the cost. And again, Minnesota Conservation Officers Association is only going to take away a profit from this conference if all the costs are covered and there's money left over. We think that grant was related to the fact that, again, by design of the hosting agreement, the costs were going to be covered and the WIA and the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association were going to walk away with money. So, you have confusion, you have informal communication, but you also have very explicit acts within the commissioner's office, assistant commissioners, deputy commissioners, and others approving significant amounts of money to be spent on this conference. That is why, Madam Chair and members, we could not, in fairness, just hold Colonel Ham or Captain Ham or others who were involved in this. We think this really was a departmental failure, not a malicious intent on the part of a few individuals.
I understand your departmental failure. One of the failures that I observe, I in no place here, and I just want to confirm my impression here, did the DNR consult with any of its attorneys? Did you find any evidence of that?
Madam Chair, I didn't find any evidence of it. It doesn't mean it didn't occur, but I didn't find evidence of it.
Okay. I mean, this is obviously governed by law. The solicitation of funds is governed by law. And it would have been an appropriate request from DNR to ask the Attorney General assigned to DNR to review it. I think that would have brought all this up rather quickly. So there seems to be a failure there to not even to think about consulting with your attorney about what was going on. So I understand that. I see the failure in the commissioner's office, but it does seem to me that we have two failures here. That Colonel Ham is the chief law enforcement officer, and he didn't know the law. That does seem to be a failure, too. A major failure.
Madam Chair, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that you can go around to various parts of the planning and hosting activities, and you can look at various documents, you can look at various communications, and you can certainly find misjudgments on the part of a number of individuals. And ultimately, as the director of the Enforcement Division, certainly Colonel Ham had a good deal of the responsibility. And Commissioner Holston will have to sort that out. That, it seems to me, is not just a matter of law, but it's a matter of what kind of action and reaction does a commissioner expect from a high-level manager within his or her department when even ad hoc informal directives are given. So I think it's completely appropriate for Commissioner Holston, as I know he's in the process of doing, to sort out the individual responsibility among a range of people who were involved. For our purpose, we thought the bigger message here is, again, at the department level, where there was really a failure to properly control the use of public resources within the department.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Noble, since we met with the Audit Commission, you, and just looking for a follow-up on anything that's happened, have you referred the data to the Ramsey County Attorney or to the Attorney General's office?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I have referred the report to the Attorney General. I was waiting for events in St. Paul to kind of clear the air before I sent it down to the Ramsey County Attorney, who I know last week was quite busy. But I intend to consult with them this week on any action they think might be appropriate. But that will take them some time to sort out.
Yes, Representative Dalby.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Mr. Nobles, I was just kind of curious if there was any illegality or impropriety discovered because of the borrowing of funds from the Game and Fish Fund and then the replacement of those funds back in the Game and Fish Fund. It just seems a little nebulous to me, and I'm wondering if that was part of your study of that behavior.
Madam Chair and members, we found the use of public money from whatever source to be inappropriate in large part. As I mentioned, about $400,000 was spent on this conference. We think about $300,000 of that was inappropriate, whether it came from Game and Fish or General Fund or whatever. But I do think, and I understand the sensitivity to the point when money comes from the Game and Fish Fund, because this legislature has established many qualifications and standards around the use of that money. Even as we began our investigation and special review, the department was looking at where the money came from for this conference and made a determination on their own that it was inappropriate to use Game and Fish money. So we thought the corrective action had already been taken. In addition, we also have an ongoing audit at the Department of Natural Resources specifically related to the department's use of Game and Fish money, which will go beyond this conference. That report is in process and should be here relatively soon. But I certainly understand the sensitivity, particularly by the members of this joint committee, whenever Game and Fish fund money is inappropriately used.
Representative Scalzi, I think these are questions we're going to want to follow up with Mr. Holston on.
Well, in this chair, as a follow-up, I'm just thinking of the conservation officers that are going to be out there meeting with the public, and the public... This is voluntary taxation in the Game and Fish Fund, those of us who buy game and fishing licenses. And to those conservation officers having to answer to the public as they do their job, I think this is a highly sensitive part of it, simply because it is such a voluntary contribution on the part of the public.
Do other folks have questions? I have another one. Yes, Representative Mattingmail.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a follow-up, Auditor Nobles, if I can, to the Audit Commission. I'm curious of the biggest part of the inappropriate money is $187,000 of payroll costs. Mm-hmm. How much of that is overtime, and how much of it was standard payroll period?
Madam Chair,
I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. When we did our work, we didn't really break it down as much by that. That 187 is an estimate based on how time was charged. That number is maybe about 5% overtime, but most of it is regular time during the week of the conference.
So if I could follow up, I'm trying to look for how you deem that to all be inappropriate. If so, the actual cash outlay to the state of Minnesota would be about $10,000 would have been additional expense above and beyond what the employees would have normally earned anyway if they'd have been doing something other than attending a conference. Then my point is, you deemed it to be inappropriate. I follow most of your trail, and you did a lot of good work. I'm trying to see where the commissioner's office told the non-CEO folks that they were not. It looks like most of this cost would be non-CEOs that attended the conference to help put the conference on. Where were they given direction? I noticed in the fundraising, it was clear Colonel Ham got notice that they weren't supposed to do fundraising on state time. That was inappropriate. But I think, what about actually, where did you see some direction that attending the conference to support it as employees on the fixed time? I could understand the overtime would deem to be inappropriate, but these folks left their regular job to attend this conference to staff booths or do whatever they were doing. I'm wondering what led you to believe that that was inappropriate. I would imagine you have some substantiation, and I'm not catching that.
Madam Chair, we looked at the agenda of the conference for one thing, and the conference ran from Sunday through Saturday. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday had no training content in them. There were various social activities, and in order to facilitate those activities, DNR conservation officers and other staff were involved in overseeing the activities, transporting people to and from the airport, doing duties that we believed were beyond the scope of what the state paying a conservation officer is for. We felt that that was outside of their normal work expectations, and that the work that they were doing or the activities that they were attending on those days and on regular payroll status with the department, that was inappropriate.
Madam Chair, if I could just elaborate on that, you might also notice, Representative McNamara and others, that because of the way the department was accounting for conservation officers' time, we actually were not able to give you an estimate of the amount of time that was used prior to the hosting of the conference for its planning. So we think the amount of state payroll costs for the planning and the actual hosting of this conference was significantly beyond the amount that we state here. And again, we think some of that would have been inappropriate because it was not related to the actual training aspects, but to other events, fishing trips, other kinds of social activities, family activities that are fine to be a part of a professional conference. We just don't think the taxpayers should pay for that. And again, I hate to harken back, but I think it's very important that it was the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association that made the commitment in writing to put on a conference of this type, which by design includes a lot of social activity, a lot of family activity, and a small amount of training, frankly. It was the Minnesota Conservation Officers, and yet the way they achieved that was by using state payroll costs and other state money and resources to achieve that. One of the ways in which we substantiated what occurred was in the testimony we obtained from people. And there was no ambiguity, frankly, in Colonel Ham's testimony on this point. We asked him quite directly, how could he justify having directed conservation officers to participate using state time on some of these planning activities and hosting of these social events?
and he said it was simply, by his directive, a work-related activity. He thought it might involve some leadership training and some other things that he thought were worthwhile. We simply disagree.
And I strongly agree, Auditor Nobles, with your thoughts, thank you, Madam Chair, that some of that was inappropriate. I still just, real quick, if you can tell me, I'm trying to see direction from the Commissioner's office that non-CO people helping facilitate the conference with non-overtime money, which it looks like that's the vast amount of this. So I'm envisioning some Fish and Wildlife, some Parks and Trails person, you know, was asked, hey, we need so many people to staff this. Can you come? One, do you have examples if they went on Sunday that they took a different day off so that it clearly was they were going there with taking a different day off? Or do we have any direction from the Commissioner's office that anybody working at this conference, not attending it, needs to do that on personal time? Because you clearly have taken all that time during the conference and said it was inappropriate, but I'm trying to follow, where did the Commissioner's office tell them that was inappropriate? That's what I was wondering. I agree with you. I wish you could substantiate, because you have an email that said they weren't supposed to spend time doing it, and I agree, and I wish we knew how much that was up leading to the conference. But my question surrounds $187,000, which it sounds like $175,000 or something is fixed time that the state would have incurred whether these people were working on a Parks and Trails issue or attending this conference. I'm wondering where is the inappropriateness that we determine that? I mean, I agree with you, maybe personally you don't agree that it was appropriate for them to attend, but do we have some justification? These employees may not have known that.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, we agree that the employees themselves did not know, we think, from the evidence we obtained, that they were doing something inappropriate. In fact, by Cohan's testimony, we believe that he directed them to participate in these activities. And I do not know of any evidence, though, of the department, the commissioner's office, saying that was appropriate or not appropriate. That occurred at the direction of Colonel Ham. And you might want to look at his testimony. It's available. We can get it to you. We asked him very directly about this as a justification. And again, it's what I said a minute ago, is that he felt that even though it was unrelated to training, unrelated to enforcement activities directly out in the field, that it was justified to use state time for those purposes.
Let me follow up on this question and start to back. One of the reasons you couldn't track all the time, the taxpayer-funded time spent on planning this conference, is because DNR didn't direct its employees to track conference planning payroll costs. That's another failure. Do they normally not have people track things like that? Was this an aberration, or do they just not have people track their time at all?
Madam Chair, they do have a special time reporting system. I think the commissioner would undoubtedly like to address that. They do have a time reporting system. We found it difficult to follow in some cases. We found that it didn't provide us with the information that we needed, as we say, and you just quoted. So it leaves a lot to be desired. We kind of put it under a microscope for trying to track the activities of this conference, but I think you're alluding to the possibility that there's a bigger problem here, particularly since we are often justifying the use of game and fish money or other dedicated money through a time reporting system that we found to be, at least in this special review, quite inadequate. But we had discussed this with the commissioner. I think he will acknowledge the deficiencies of this time reporting system and would like something better. But that's where I will leave it, Madam Chair. There's definitely a deficiency in time reporting. Where time reporting is very important to you and the public and the people who pay for those licenses in terms of accountability, it's deficient.
Is it deficient just in this area dealing with the conference, or is it generally deficient?
Well, Madam Chair, we only looked at this conference, and it certainly was deficient in that regard. But what I hear from others in the department, and in some degree in our other audit work, that there are difficulties more generally. But I think the commissioner who is here will probably want to address that as well.
Yeah, I hope he'll put that on his list. Senator Bach.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is probably more addressed to the commissioner, but you know, at DNR, there's all of these dedicated accounts. The Game and Fish Fund, the Natural Resources Fund has a number of different accounts in it. What I'm interested in knowing, and I hope that their internal review is going to show us, probably real hard to track the planning time, but certainly the time spent at the conference, how people charged out their time for those days, I think is kind of important. If a water rec account was charged, or the snowmobile account, or what accounts were charged, I suspect the department's internal review might tell us that. But, you know, those are pretty strong advocacy groups that advocated for those accounts, and we often appropriate additional money there for specific purposes. And I hope the commissioner is prepared to talk about that a little bit.
I certainly agree with you, Senator Bach, but Mr. Nobles, do you have comment on that?
Not beyond what I've already said, Madam Chair. I think it is it's a very important issue. We understand that. We've done a number of audits and evaluations of game and fish-related activities. We've met with many of the constituency groups that are concerned about accountability for those funds. So, and we recognize the legislature's very close role in defining, legally defining, how those monies can be used. So this is a very important aspect of accountability that needs a lot of follow-up. And again, we'll be having some additional audit work for you soon.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to ask about your recommendation that the department should work with the Attorney General's office to try to recoup the profit that was gained by the two organizations to the tune of $76,000 plus. And I'm wondering, first of all, if you think there's any, you know, we don't have any real legal standing to do that, do we? Have you talked to the Attorney General's office about that? Do you think there's a possibility of getting some of that taxpayer money back? And why stop at the profit? Why not try to recoup some of the other costs that really were not appropriate use of taxpayer money?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the Attorney General's office is reviewing the report and will be coming to our office to review our work papers. That's sort of a normal part of our exchange with them. It is going to be a challenge, frankly, particularly to recoup money from NOEA, which is not an organization with residency in Minnesota. So leverage there is not good, but with the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association, which took a lesser amount of the profit, but still took a profit and had the state cover the cost, we think that there ought to be some effort, and I think that that the Attorney General ought to take that issue seriously. I think part of the challenge is on the side of the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association is all of the money that they received, they felt they received it through, again, official authorization from the department, and they used it for purposes that they believe were authorized by officials in DNR. I'm sure that'll be their argument, that they came by that money honestly, that they used it honestly, and they should be able to keep it. But that'll be for the lawyers to sort out as to how strong a case they have. As to going after additional money beyond the profit, the difficulty is, who do you go after for those funds?
You know, it to some degree is asking the department to come up with money from somewhere, but that somewhere is only going to be from the money that you appropriate to them, which will take funds away from something you want them to do. So, but if the Attorney General or others can figure out a way that some of the taxpayer money can be made whole here, I think that would be a good thing.
And following up on... go ahead. Yes.
I'll defer to you because I have a completely different question.
Some of those monies you specifically list on page 17 and 18, and just a couple of them. There was a registration. They paid a registration fee higher than the one stated in the conference brochure, and DNR paid registration fees for 26 other employees who actually worked at the conference that weren't getting any training because they weren't conservation officers. And then there was a registration fee for volunteers. Well, that's three of the six that you list in here. Who authorized those?
Well, Madam Chair, that would have been authorized through the Enforcement Division. I don't recall exactly evidence within the business office. Was there from Jerry Hampton? I stand corrected. That was a part of the special expense that was approved by a deputy DNR commissioner.
A deputy DNR commissioner authorized paying a registration fee higher than the one stated in the conference brochure. I just want to make this crystal clear. And authorized registration fees for the 26 other employees who worked at the conference. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And authorized 110 registration fee for volunteers, knowing that all this money, this taxpayer money, was going to the union. Mm-hmm. So there was also lodging and meals and parking and other meals and other expenses. But so that was all authorized by a DNR commissioner.
Deputy commissioner.
Madam Chair,
yes, and it shouldn't have occurred. I'm sure that that deputy commissioner would now, in retrospect, tell you the same thing. But I think it tells you in this example of how this all unfolded and evolved. It was in bits and pieces. And frankly, with all due respect, I don't think this particular deputy commissioner had a clear idea of what was going on with this conference. Again, because there was no document, no formal communication that defined what the department's role was. This particular deputy commissioner came in after Commissioner Merriam, for example, was gone. And there was some loss of, I think, communication and clarity in some of the transition that was going on. But again, that's why you write things down, so that people don't misinterpret, misunderstand, when there are a variety of people involved in authorizing various kinds of expenses. But clearly, it was another opportunity for this deputy commissioner. You point to other officials in the department who had opportunities, even though their knowledge was limited, that when a particular expense or a particular document was put in front of them, for them to step back and ask the bigger questions about what was going on. And that didn't occur. Or if it did occur, they felt comforted enough that they went ahead and signed the document. In this case, we think clearly it was inappropriate.
Thank you.
Mr. Noble, it's a completely different type of question. When this conference has been held in other states or provinces of Canada, has it been self-sustaining, or have other states in some way or another subsidized this conference?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, we don't know for sure. We tried to communicate with NOEA, but only in a very limited way. But I think it is our impression from looking at websites from previous conferences, looking at the hosting agreement, and frankly, from Colonel Ham's testimony, from Captain Ham's testimony, and all the others that we talked to,
that yes, other states have participated, that it has not been just self-sustaining from the private organizations. I think Colonel Hammond, his testimony to us, and again, it's available to you if you'd like to read it, he was quite clear that this conference could not have been successful under the terms of the NOAA, Minnesota Conservation Officers Association Agreement, unless there had been a large commitment of public resources in terms of money and time. Our concern is that although Colonel Ham seemed to understand that, and others within the enforcement division, that that's the way these conferences work, wherever they're held, that people in the department seem to not have that understanding, or were kind of running to catch up to get that understanding. I would point out, for example, that Commissioner Merriam was only aware that the conference was coming to Minnesota after the commitment was made between the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association and NOAA. And I do not think he or others had a very clear understanding of what the commitment meant in terms of the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, Auditor Noble, I just want to whip through a couple of these numbers and hope that when you, and it's a question I'll ask of the commissioner when he comes up. I'm looking at the paper trail that we have. The grant of $35,500. Captain Ham herself said that it may not be appropriate to take it because they were going to end up with a profit. So I certainly, absolutely would think that your recommendation to the Attorney General would get that money back. The $25,000 fee credit never gotten from, however you pronounce it, Nawawi, clearly should be given back. That was inappropriate to not take that waiver, and that would be $25,000 of additional state money that would come back. And then I think that all the conferences and things that I've ever attended, if you volunteer, you don't pay a registration. You get a comp. The $5,200 for the $200 registration is inappropriate, and I would think MCOA should reimburse the DNR for that, and the $5,610. I mean, all this together is about $70,000. That, and I'll mention it, but I just hope that you, in your role, would at the very least look at that. And then the vast amount of the inappropriate during the conference time seems to be fixed cost to the state. So whether, I agree with you, I think, and actually I believe, as you said, up front there was additional wrong cost. But I hope you will let the Attorney General, this $70,000 is due the state of Minnesota, and we should get it back.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, we will certainly work with the Attorney General. They ultimately will have to decide whether to negotiate an agreement to achieve a voluntary repayment from Minnesota Conservation Officers or file a civil suit. That is, those are the options available in any of the cases where we seek repayment. But ultimately, that decision will be with the Attorney General, but I certainly will advocate strongly that the state take action.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles or Spurkle, on page 21 and 22, it discusses three individuals who refused to be interviewed. How common is that in your experience in these types of audits for people to refuse to be interviewed?
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, it's unprecedented, and it was disturbing to us. We decided to leave it there, as I indicate in the narrative that precedes their name, for a variety of reasons, which I stated. But we believe that these state employees should have obeyed the law, a law which you put into effect, I think, for a very good reason, and that is when there are cases like this, you want a strong, vigorous legislative investigation. And you want cooperation from state employees. Just to fill out the story here of why they did not cooperate, they were advised by their attorney to assert their Fifth Amendment right, which they certainly, I think we would all agree, have a right to. And you may believe that that trumps their obligation under the law to cooperate. I thought it was ill-advised for them to assert a Fifth Amendment right in this case. I at the time, and still to this day, don't know why they would necessarily do that, but they did. We saw it more as an opportunity for them to explain to us from their perspective why they did what they did. We weren't looking to trick them or nail them, so to speak. We were looking to give them an opportunity in an appropriate setting with their attorney present to give us a full rendition of what occurred from their perspective. They chose not to do that. Their attorney asked that we immunize their testimony. First of all, I don't have the authority to do that. I could have only done that if I had gone to court, subpoenaed them, and then gone to a district court to seek enforcement of that subpoena under a court order. And the judge could have considered a use immunity for that testimony. I just chose not to go down that road. I felt that given the strength of this law and their obligation as a state employee, they should have come forth and given us the testimony that we sought.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, is this one of the issues that you'll be submitting to either the Attorney General, Ramsey County Attorney, or both?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, we will discuss this with both. I'm sure, as you know, not every law not complied with results in a crime that can be prosecuted. But this is a disturbing situation, and I hope certainly that it is not repeated.
Well, Madam Chair, along those lines, can you just give us your opinion about how many officials or employees at the DNR broke state laws?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, all of those who went out and participated in fundraising using state resources, their state positions, we believe were not in compliance with 43A, .38, subdivision 5, which says that it is a conflict of interest to use your office, your position, to seek money, favors, advantage, gifts. I'm not quoting here, I'm saying this from memory. Not only that for your personal benefit or the benefit of a family member, but also to the benefit of an association with which you're associated, and clearly that fits the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. And I think there is a very, very clear documented paper trail that says to us that the reason for the fundraising was to benefit the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. And they used their offices, their state resources, their positions to do exactly that. So anyone that did that, we believe, was in violation of Minnesota statutes, which is the Code of Conduct for Employees in the Executive Branch. Again, just to repeat, the only mitigation to that, we believe, is that they believed, and I think they believed it sincerely, that they were operating not only within the law, but under what is referred to as DNR Operational Order 101. That order came up a lot in testimony we received from conservation officers on this issue. They believe that that order, which is used for the department to do fundraising and receive gifts from private sources, they believe that they were in compliance with that order. We do not believe they were in compliance with that order or with in compliance with the law. But again, we don't sit here or in our report and point fingers of culpability because, again, the commissioner's office approved a fundraising letter that said that both the department and the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association were involved in a partnership to co-host this conference, and as a part of that, they were raising money to support the conference from private sources.
Madam Chair, Mr. Noble, you said that the employees that you interviewed believed that they were
following the law because they were following DNR Directive 101. Did you get that answer all the way up to the commissioner's office from the deputy commissioners and the higher level officials that you interviewed, that they said that as well?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I think there's a good deal of confusion within DNR. I think there were people who felt that in the business office and other places within DNR who certainly had questions and doubts as to whether or not this particular fundraising complied with Operational Order 101, the law, or the precedence of other fundraising activities. But I admit myself that it is a little bit murky in terms of the precedence. I think the law is clear. I think Operational Order 101 is relatively clear. I think it could use some work. But I think, frankly, the precedence within DNR lends some confusion to the situation. We were told by conservation officers under oath that what they did for this conference in terms of fundraising is what they do all the time for other activities related to DNR. So they, again, were going not only on their belief that they were in compliance with the law and Operational Order 101, but on past practice, which had never been questioned.
Are there other questions? Is there any other questions, please, Noble? I don't see any. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Commissioner? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Mark Wolfson, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Let me start by saying a few things. I want to thank the auditor for the work that they've done and come in and come into the department, because we take this matter very seriously, and it's a high level of concern for us. And as we are trying to unravel the events that happened over a 3-plus-year period of time, a year and a half after the fact, having the resources of the auditor to be able to come in and take that financial look and identify areas of our policies and procedures that need to be updated or clarified is actually a good asset. I do need to be very explicitly clear. We are in the middle of trying to, through our own, it's not ours, we contracted with the Department of the Doer to hire an outside investigator to come in and do a detailed analysis that comes in and answers the hows and the whys. As many of you have been asking those questions here this morning, many of the hows and the whys, could this take place? And those are the questions that we are very interested in trying to get and get those put together. As I said, as we talked back in late May, this spring, it's going to take us some time to unravel that 3 years of history and then create that clear picture of what actually transpired and didn't transpire. There are some issues here within the report, but over the most part, the report lays out some of those difficulties or some of those problems internally within the agency from a systematic perspective, from a systems view of what took place or did not take place. And we're going to be and we're dealing with many of those questions right now, and others that some have been highlighted here this morning that are not in the report, but things that we are ultimately going to have to correct in our operations. As we try to answer these questions for you this morning, Madam Chair, be patient with us in trying to make sure that we don't dive out into the areas of the hows and the whys, because those are going to be areas that we want to take a very sincere and honest and aggressive look at in how we move forward as commissioner with the internal corrections and any actions that we have to take place in the next several weeks. So with that, Madam Chair, you have some questions?
Well, I think if we want to start off with one of the fundamental questions that would not be governed by any of the things you just said,
is, and then we've gotten that question from Representative Scalzi, from Senator Back, and others, where did the money come from that was spent for this conference?
Madam Chair, originally, when it was reported and as we went in and looked, all the billings that occurred, we believe, happened in the Game and Fish Fund. We went back and did a analysis on trying to look at what were the, through the conference, the training and the educational aspects, what could be transferred to other accounts, because we didn't believe, as I suspect you don't, that the Game and Fish Fund should have been the sole bearer of any type of training or educational activity. So we went in and looked at that and tried to pull out what we could.
Commissioner, this is not training and education. I think that the auditor set that aside.
Right.
We're talking about expenses that were inappropriate.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to give you the whole picture
okay.
of everything that transpired. The vast majority of the expenditures were on personnel. And how do those personnel costs get distributed across the agency? We had the sum total back in the spring of this year of what we anticipated those costs were, and we tried to we had a number in mind, and that was in the area of what we've been talking about, the $300,000 plus. And we had to make some definitive decisions back then, especially as we came to the close of the fiscal year. So we went in, took a look at what training and educational components were provided, tried to pull those costs out, and what could be fully attributed to other accounts. We then had to make some decisions, and we basically went to simplify things to the gross appropriations to the department or to the enforcement division, and how those accounts are distributed in a individual payroll, and did that analysis, and then plugged those dollars in separately. So what you have is a breakdown of the roughly approximate number of $400,000, $60,000 out of the general fund, $230,000 out of the Game and Fish Fund, $100,000 out of the Natural Resources Fund, and nearly $200,000 out of the Remediation Fund. Is where those dollars are now being attributed to for the conference.
And what went undone that we had thought we had appropriated money for?
Madam Chair, as we said, most of that would have been in salary costs. So it was time spent at the conference that should have been done in the field, and that would have been roughly a 1 week's worth of an enforcement officer's time in the field. At that particular time of the year, you're looking at a lot of water rec activity, a lot of game and fish activity, some ATV enforcement, and that would have been the primary bulk of a lot of their time. That would have been the big area, and there'd been 1 week's worth of work in the field.
Well, but it was pointed out very clearly that there was a lot of planning time, too. So it's not just the week that people were in St. Paul,
right.
But it was the planning time. And I think it's not, doesn't work just to say, well, water rec and what specifically didn't get done? What were officers supposed to be doing that didn't get done? What can taxpayers expect that they would have been doing that didn't get done?
Well, Madam Chair, as I said, if you look at an independent officer in the work that they do in any given week, they have somewhat level of discretion in terms of within their geographical area what to go and work on, what are the hot button items. And as I say, particularly during the conference, they would have been on the water. They would have been bumping boats. They would have been patrolling for DWI, boating while DWI. They would have been fish violations. Would have been a large part of their work. They would have been in the forest looking for ATV enforcement activities. That would have been the bulk of the activity, and that's where you would have seen the lost effort. It's very difficult to put a time or dollar amount in terms of what any individual would have done. That was the basic essence of that particular time. When you go back into and look at the planning and development, as the auditor pointed out, time tracking has become very difficult because of how the division coded their time for this activity. It got put into a generic code time of business operations or business support. And that becomes a very nebulous coding and not one that we can actually go in and pull out and give any type of significant weight to.
Let's backtrack a little here. When we try to figure out what didn't happen, let's look at it from another direction. How do you measure performance, or put another way, how do you measure outcomes for your officers?
Mm-hmm.
And if we can do, we can look at those outcomes measures, then we can figure out what went undone.
We do planning documents that lay out for you during the budgetary process and also through our But during our budget documents, we lay out expected levels of enforcement work that we are able to achieve within the budgets that we present. One of the things that we talked about was recreational vehicle enforcement. We lay out a goal or perspective of what we think we'll do with those accounts. We estimated at that level we would have been in the somewhere between the 18 and 21,000 hours of on-the-ground enforcement work around ATV enforcement. We actually, this last year, during that fiscal year, 07 and 08, were in the 25 to 22. So we actually met or slightly exceeded those marks. When we talk about wetland enforcement, we made that a priority, as you made it a priority budgetary-wise, we made it an operational priority. We actually exceeded those goals by several thousand hours of on-the-ground enforcement work or in-the-air enforcement work. We haven't been able to go in and pull out all of those goals and measurements, but those are the majors that we focus in on. Education and training was another one where we put a lot of energy and focus into, and we either met or exceeded those. I haven't gone in and done that complete analysis of everything that we measure on and what did we come up short on. I haven't been able to pull that up. But the majors were the ones that we went and tried to take a look at. We knew we were going to make a major effort in enforcement, in recreational enforcement, in wetland enforcement, in training, and those were some of the areas that we hit or exceeded our marks.
Well, even though you exceeded your marks, you could have exceeded them a lot more had there not been this week off. So we need to, I think we need to know a little more specifically what went undone.
Madam Chair, that's a real simple statement to make, and I appreciate that. It's a little more complicated than that because you still have to look at that particular time frame and what those officers would have been doing, and they may not have been engaged in that activity. So it's, I don't want to minimize the question because it's an important one. When you start talking about these volumes of dollars and distribute them across those employees, those enforcement division officers, what work are they not getting done? It's an important one, and we'll try to answer that in more detail. But from the data that we were able to pull from the report and now go back, it takes a lot of time.
I remember when you all came for your budget about a year and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that enforcement asked for was more money for training, mm-hmm. for a training school for a new class of officers.
The academy.
Pardon?
For an academy.
Yes. Did any of this money come from that, or did the academy go forth, and how many folks do you have in the academy?
We do not have an academy running right now. We did have an academy last spring where we graduated, I believe, 10 officers through that academy. We are in, as we go through our planning documents, looking at our vacancies and projected vacancies, be making the determination here in the next couple of weeks if we'll move forward with an academy this year or the following year. I don't know. I don't believe that decision has been made yet.
If I recall testimony, I thought we were aiming for more than 10 new folks, that there were going to be vacancies greater than could be filled with.
Madam Chair, as we have gone through the last 6 years, we have been asking for regular academy dollars to rebuild from the volume we were at, or the deficiencies in officers we were at 6 years ago, to fill that void. And so we have been, over a period of time, correcting that deficiency, getting to complement, and now we are on the back side of that massive bubble of retirement. I don't know what the numbers are specifically. I believe we are sitting somewhere in the area of 8 to 10 vacancies right now. And we'll have to make a determination whether we're going to have an academy this year or next. But I think we've only hit the mark once where we've been able to fund an academy, deal with the backlog, deal with the outgoing to actually get the complement. You hit that full complement, and with retirements you immediately start to digress, and filling that in behind is just a continual process.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, I received a report that it's become official DNR policy to not enforce the latest DOC general permit limits, citing staffing concerns as at least part of the rationale, and there was an email to this effect that I can't produce it, but it's within writing. Right.
I need to.
So
just so I understand which one we're talking about, I'd like to just see that. Who is it from? Do you know?
No.
Okay.
Are they doing it?
One
of your supervisors said it's an official policy. So
well,
it just concerns me that.
Madam Chair,
the public is hearing, we're not going to enforce the rules because we don't have enough staffing. But I want to know from you, from the commissioner level, is that true? And if so, doesn't that create a greater concern in light of these findings?
Madam Chair, if that would be the context of what that email references, yes. I don't know if that's the context. Understand, we identified a problem in DOCS. The Division of Waters went through an analysis and gave a general permit that exceeded the rule for DOC users up to a certain level. The legislature made a determination that we were to go in and go through the rulemaking process to reevaluate DOCS. We're in the middle of that process now. Do we devote staff resources to the enforcement of that while we are in the middle of redoing the rules? And that might be the again, without seeing the document and understanding the context of which it was in, I really would hate to comment on it.
Well, I guess apparently part of the rationale was that there's a lack of staffing available. That's the part that I'm concerned about. Obviously, there may have been some other reasons that may or may not be legitimate. But
Madam Chair, we make a very concerted effort to not use that tone of we don't have the resources. We have a lot of resources. It's a question of where do we want to use those resources most appropriately for the biggest benefit. And we make a very concerted effort into doing that. So is it the context of we don't have enough resources to do that? I don't believe that's it. It's do we want to use our resources in that way? And if somebody characterized it differently, I'd like to see that document so I can deal with it.
Well, Madam Chair, Commissioner, I'm not out trying to get someone in trouble in your agency. That's not the point of the question.
No.
The point is to know if you know what's going on around the state in your agency,
and if there's clear rules that are being set forth by the commissioner's office that are being followed, and if not, is there accountability? I mean, this is all part of the same issue that we're looking at. Is there, you know, is someone in charge of these kinds of things, and is there a staffing shortage in the agency that this expenditure, this inappropriate use of staff time made worse?
Madam Chair, I would not, the context in which the question is and the context of what that email references, I wouldn't venture to do that.
And
again, I'm not about witch hunting here, but if I've got people communicating different messages than the messages that are designed, I need to see that and understand that so I can correct that.
And Madam Chair, on a slightly different topic, can I ask about, I understand that there was that COs were sent to help with security at the RNC in the last week.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many attended and to help, and how are they being paid?
Madam Chair, we had 100 officers assigned. I believe 99 actually worked the event. That is an expense that will be reimbursed through the global DNC RNC convention reimbursement process that is provided by the federal government.
And how did that, 100 officers or 99 officers not on the job on Labor Day weekend, what kind of problems did that cause around the state?
Madam Chair, we asked...
Besides in St. Paul.
Madam Chair,
St. Paul was very well protected last week. Extremely well protected. But what about the rest of the
sure.
state?
Sure, Madam Chair, and those were the decisions as... When the legislature made the decision to take game wardens and make them full-fledged statewide law enforcement officers responsible for all enforcement activities, is what they are, they become part of that eligible pool. So as officers were pulled from a variety of different areas, we were asked to provide a certain level. We asked the Division of Enforcement to look at those particular geographical areas and make a determination, could we provide that level of service based upon the activities going on in the state. Understand that is Memorial Weekend. It is also is the beginning of the bear season, the dove season. There's some special goose seasons going on. So we had to go in and take a look, and the division made those judgment calls. Where could those officers come from? And
maybe we don't need that. If we don't need them on Labor Day weekend, maybe we don't need that many officers at all.
Madam Chair, that's a policy decision and budget decision you'll have to make.
But, Madam Chair, Commissioner, do you have an opinion on that? You think we have too many COs in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, no, I don't. I don't believe that, day in, day out. But I also know that when special events occur, we often pull our officers out to go do specific things, whether it's a convention and security and enforcement around that, whether it's a flood in the Rushford area and go provide life safety activities there, whether it's the flood in the Red River Valley, our officers roll when they are asked to, as law enforcement officers are, in emergency and security detail.
Madam Chair, can I just ask, are there other examples? You said that when they're asked to provide security, can you give me any other examples? Not in a flood emergency type situation, a natural disaster?
Madam Chair, there was an issue during the strike, and I don't remember what the details of what their deployment was or what they actually did. But there are...
Right?
Well, that was 8 years ago. That one just comes to mind. We were asked to provide statewide resources. We went in and looked and made that determination that we could. As we do, again, countless times.
Madam Chair?
I have other questions. I think it's Representative Gartner and Representative Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been, pouring through the special reviewer with interest. What is the penalty for violating a DNR operational order? I can't say that I really know what that is. I mean, what the departmental order is according to, rather than just a memo or a thing like that.
Madam Chair, Representative, these operational orders, these are the the backdrop behind an operational order is generally statute. So we take statute and provide some guidance in what that statute provides and how to do it. So what you have is, when you ask the question, what's the penalty? The penalty can be anywhere from a oral reprimand, a written reprimand, time off, or dismissal.
As a follow-up, Madam Chair, in a lot of the findings here in the recommendations, they talk about clarifying policies and procedures and so on, and I think that's helpful. Will it make a difference if things like departmental orders no one's following? You know, are we going to have policies and procedures that just go on a shelf somewhere?
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the things that we want to be cautious of doing is just not replicating policies for policy purposes and additional bureaucratic tape for the purposes of doing. We need to make sure, and that's what we believe our audit or our investigation will be able to fill many of those holes behind, be able to tell us, was this a willful, wanton disregard for the operation, or was this a misunderstanding that we need to correct, or problems within those communication standards, directions within the policy to provide better guidance. And those are the decisions that we'll have to ultimately make here in the next couple of days and weeks.
So, Madam Chair, it's within your purview as a commissioner to act on whatever may have been violated, whatever you feel was appropriate for the department order. You don't have to wait for us to do something? Or
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I do not.
It's my understanding that this operational order is just a way to implement current state law. Now, as I understand it from Mr. Nobles, the current state law is perfectly clear, and he thinks the operational order needs some clarification. When will that be done by?
Madam Chair, that is in the process right now. We have been meeting, our business office folks and the Attorney General's office have been meeting to take a look at that operational order that was revised in, I believe, 2003. It is in revision right now, and we'll be taking a more holistic look at it and determining, should we have smaller independent operational orders or continue with one and just have a larger rewrite of the whole thing. So we're pulling it apart to pull it back together.
And when can we expect that will be done?
Early October.
Thank you. If you have another question,
I think that might be great.
Senator Torrey. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I was a state employee for about 16 years, mm-hmm. and I remember that when we did this kind of events or we had to submit expense reports, I had to go to my supervisor, and then my supervisor went to the program manager, and then the program manager went to the assistant commissioner, and then the assistant commissioner went to the commissioner. So there were about 6 or 7 people involved in the process of making decisions about authorizing this kind of reimbursement. I would like to share, what is your process in DNR? And it says in this report that several expenses were made that were inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And my assumption is that several people actually participated in authorizing this process. And the auditor's office submits one recommendation, which is that we need to obtain the $76,000 back. To me, the issue is more important than the $76,000, but it's how you manage your department and who are the people that work with you to make sure that together you make the decisions that you need to make, because apparently, you know, there were issues related to printing costs, hotel, traveling, lots of, you know, departments were involved in that particular decision, and I would like to know, how do you manage those areas and who is involved in making those decisions?
Sure. Without getting into the details of the individual, I want to be careful, as I'm about to receive a report and have to make some decisions about. You have a policy where it would have come up through much the same pain that you described as those events are happening. So you would have had it involved, any individual involved within the division, but it would have gone through their supervisor, through their business office, their divisional business office. It would have gone through their director, and that director through our agency-wide business office, and then through that process to our commissioner's office for sign-off by the director. It would not have, they generally do not go to the commissioner. They go to the commissioner's office for final approval. So you have a series of staff, divisional business office within the division director, or and subordinates within his management team or her management team, to the agency-wide business office, and then into the commissioner's office.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, my question is then, was this kind of a unique case in which, you know, it seems that those decisions were made at all of these levels and got to you and continued to happen, they were authorized? Or is it appropriate for us to say that if we investigate other events or other administrative decisions, we will run into the same situation? Because these are the same people who, I assume, authorize and approve other expenses, right? This is not, they were not assigned only this particular conference. So am I correct to assume that this is the way things happen in your department, or this is an isolated case because it has a specific kind of a characteristic? I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
No, you
because
are.
This is not one conference, right? You do a lot of things like that. Everything happens within those kind of administrative responsibilities. But is this a unique case, or do we assume that this kind of happens and nobody knows what's going on in your department?
I would say this. You put a number of different points out there that I would like to touch on each one. This is a unique one in that it encompasses an entire division. There are embedded in that conference, you have an independent association signing the agreement, creating the liability for them to host and be responsible for the financial benefit or not benefit for that. But an agency who also is then embedded within that from the educational and training component, as was understood. So we don't have conferences like this. This is not an everyday conference. Now, state conferences for state employees are, that's a regular occurrence, but where it's here in Minnesota, and specifically to one entity, one independent entity, that's only in one department, one agency, is not a normal practice that we see very often. Or I don't think state government sees very often. We think this, the report, we hope will shed light further on that. And as we look deeper into our system, do we have some things that need to be corrected? Overall, the agency. Obviously, there are some agency-wide processes that we are, business processes that we are correcting. So we have those stopgaps in place. But I want to be careful to make sure that we don't overstep. I'm reserving judgment on whether this is an isolated case inside the department for right now. I'm reserving that judgment. To your other point, we have an issue, and one that was touched on here. It's not in the report, but something that was touched on. During this three plus years of planning, fundraising, and execution of, we had massive turnover in the administrative offices of the department. And so we have a number of different people who either leave the agency, who had hands on it from an administrative perspective, commissioner's level, and then new people coming in. And one of the things I don't believe we have right now is a good way to transition, as often happens every 4 years, a major transition in the activity, and that's something at a commissioner's level that we're going to have to take a look at, and how to make sure information transfers from one administration to the next after the next election. I don't want to leave my predecessor, whoever that, and his team with this same type of problem and misunderstanding of what's going on behind them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was interesting your comment that you were reserving judgment on whether this is an isolated incident. Please let us know when you make that determination.
Well, Madam Chair, I will, and I'm trying to use my words carefully. Understand? We are taking a look at other work that's being done, or other conferences that are coming in, or we send people to, and how that occurs. So there are adjustments being made. This was a big one, obviously, not just from a monetary sense, but from the involvement. This was supposed to replace a Camp Ripley year's training event and make it at this event. So this was big. We don't have anything like this normally.
Lots of little ones can add up. Senator Bond.
Well, Madam Chair, just let me suggest maybe for the two chairmen to consider. I'm still thinking about how we can keep all these dedicated accounts whole for some misappropriated money. And something, I guess, for the chairs to consider. When we passed the budget, we funded the Enforcement Division and all their FTEs for 52 weeks a year. And now the department has incurred salary savings for a week for approximately 100 people, probably over a couple $1,000s a week by the time you place salary and all the other associated expenses, and I'm sure there was overtime involved in the event. I would think that the reimbursement coming from the RNC or through the City of St. Paul or however it comes to the department, it's got to be in the neighborhood of $250,000. Now, that is money over and above what the legislature appropriated. So it seems to me that if we could hang on to that money, it's over and above what we appropriated to fund the agency, there should be a way to use that money to correct the errors that the legislative auditor found. And I'm not sure if I'm exactly thinking accurately here, but it seems like the department's coming into a windfall of a significant amount of money by being able to shift people off payroll, essentially, for a week. So it seems like there should be a pot of money there that if we can't legally recover money to replace those dedicated accounts, it seems like there is potentially a pot of money that the legislative committees could consider reallocating in some way. Just offer that up to the chairs, I think, and the fiscal analysts to consider, because it does seem like there is some money over and above the budget coming to the department.
And that would be an appropriate thing for next January.
Madam Chair, tax committees are always asked to find money. So I always kind of think that way.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Buck, let me make sure I'm following what you're saying here. I mean, I think the RNC piece of it is, I don't think we'll probably get any extra money back beyond what was already expended from the department, from the Game and Fish Fund.
No, my point is, Madam Chair, we appropriated 52 weeks of salary for those people. And for 100 of them, we're only going to pay them 51.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So somewhere there's a week in salary savings because somebody else is going to pay them for a week. So there should be some additional money somewhere in the department once the reimbursement comes. Maybe I can ask one of our fiscal analysts.
Yes.
Senator Frederickson looking at me. Maybe Senator Frederickson, am I on the right track? Is there some salary savings there?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I think there would be. But if, just from what I understand in the media, didn't Minnesota receive like $50 million of money from the federal government for security, as did Colorado? And I would think when that money comes, that would have to explicitly be used for the work they did at the convention. But then that savings, I would think, we could at least look at reallocating.
Well, I guess it depends if those RNC officers were paid for out of the salary money or out of the Game and Fish appropriation, out of Game and Fish dollars. And I guess we didn't really get a clear answer to that. But it certainly bears looking at.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Holston, I realize you can't talk about the investigation that's going on, but you were in a different role when Commissioner Merriam, you were a deputy commissioner, and so I want to ask about your role and just, you know, when did you find out about this conference, and is your signature on any of the special expense forms? I'd like you to maybe just tell the committee a little bit about that.
As deputy, I was aware in a very basic way that there was a conference out there. I was involved in the meeting where Commissioner Merriam, myself, Commissioner Moore talked about the event. We had just learned that it was coming to Minnesota and that MCOA had gone out, secured it coming in, and talked about what was the appropriate role for the state in. And after that meeting, my involvement was very critical. In that I wasn't involved in the management of it or the signing of documents around it, and just had that very basic knowledge that something was going on, but not really in an official capacity of management of it.
Chair, as commissioner, did you go to the conference?
Madam Chair, I have then been made commissioner when the conference came. I did go to the conference. I attended the opening ceremonies where I gave the welcoming address to the convention. It was on a Wednesday.
Did you get any feedback from employees or conservation officers about this is a good conference, or why do we have to be here? Or, I mean, do you have that ability where, you know, an employee can come up to you and just say, you know, this is really a good session, or anything like that happen?
I had some, trying to recall. I had some conversation with Colonel Hamm, who expressed his belief that it was a good conference and that it was, everything went well.
Madam Chair, and afterwards, was there any, since the department was co-sponsoring, was there any evaluation or postscript getting together? I was a state employee, like Senator Torres Ray, and I used to have to write evaluations or a summary if I went to a conference, what happened there. Was there any meeting like that where you looked at what happened? And
at admissions office level, no. And we need to remember that from what we understood to be happening versus what happened are two different things. Our understanding was the event was coming, the association secured it, it was the association event. Our officers would go and get their training and education there. So our focus was limited to just the training and education. And that was from a very step back look, what happened there. Now, we're doing a lot more looking into what kind of benefit did we get? Can we attribute a actual benefit that would have secured the resources of the state to hold this event? Then there's the nominal that are the independent individual benefits that an individual might get from the networking, from the any of the planning activities that they may have been involved in. Those would have been peripheral things, but yet not ones that would have met the criteria for a state involvement, state dollar involvement in. And so that's what we're kind of sorting out right now.
And then finally, Commissioner, and at the Audit Commission, I asked this because we had a series of audits, but I'm not sure if you were still in the room, but has there been any cabinet meeting, or have you talked with your peers or other commissioners about standard operating procedures that develop criteria for the future if some of these things come in? So across the executive branch, there's a kind of some clarity.
Is this even discussed or?
Obviously, the cabinet is aware of what's going on. We haven't had a cabinet level discussion about this, but in my letter to the auditor, we will be meeting with the doer and admin to talk about conferences particularly and make sure that we have a uniform, try to develop a more uniform set of standards. But that is something that, yes, the administration will be doing.
And just to comment, and I realize we're running short of time, but I mean, I think we want conventions to come to the state. We want conferences to come to the state. You know, as a state employee, I went to conferences. As a legislator, we go to conferences. There is value in that. But the report says there needs to be clarity and that there needs to be a clear definition of lines of responsibility. And so I would hope that we don't have to repeat this effort in agency after agency or in the same agency again.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I wholeheartedly agree with you. And I believe, again, from that perspective, this is an isolated case. A very isolated case.
Commissioner, let me just follow up. I see two more questions here, but let me follow up on one of Representative Hansen's questions. You said that you were in the room with Commissioner Merriam and Assistant Commissioner Brad Moore when, after it was learned that this conference was coming to Minnesota. Was that the meeting where Commissioner Merriam said the department would not allocate public resources to a private organization?
Yes.
You were there and heard that conversation?
Yes.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, did I understand you to say you have annual trainings at Fort Ripley for your officers?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is our education center. That is at Fort Ripley. So we have annual training for officers. They attend there. We have our training officer there.
And so how would the cost of that event compare to the expense that you had at this event? And what was the comparison in terms of the quality of what officers received?
Embedded within the budget documents, so as you appropriate money to the department, within their salaries is a portion that is dedicated towards education and training. So those dollars would have been used to do that. What we understood or what we believed to be a transferable education training event, I think what we're beginning to see is it wasn't quite that as good.
So
from that formal sense, remember when I Representative Hansen, we talked about what we can articulate as good, sound training that we can defend as the resources of the state. That may not, we don't believe that's as good as we believed it to have been, as we are now going back and taking a second look at it. Looking at the non-monetary or non-official, I think there was more benefit to our officers in the attendance of this conference.
And you said that under normal circumstances, it's built into their salary, so the expenses for this particular conference was above and beyond their salary?
The planning and the fundraising and planning for the conference would have been above and beyond the educational training and preparation that would have occurred.
Well, and Senator Rummel, I think we also heard about that beyond the training, there were days of attendance that didn't have training at them. There was fees for registration for people who weren't being trained. There were all kinds of conference-related expenses that had nothing to do with actual training as well. So I think that's pretty well documented in this report. Commissioner, Representative Hansen was asking about cabinet discussions. Have you discussed this with the governor?
Not me personally, no. I have with the chief of staff. He's aware of it, and we talk about this, and he understands what the direction we're going, and the directions that we are going to need to go, and the decisions that we have to make.
Has he set any expectations for changes in the department, or any consequences in the department?
I don't believe he has to. He hasn't.
I'm just asking if he has.
He has not given me any direction beyond get the fix. I mean, it's very clear, as it is from you to me, from my boss to me, that we've got to get this thing cleaned up, wrapped up, so that we can move on. One, so that it doesn't happen again. Two, so that we can secure the trust of the public and you again, and so that we can actually meet our missions and goals. We need to get this corrected so we can move on.
And on that note, I think all of us would like to see a specific plan that we can look at in sometime in the near future that would lay out exactly what you're intending to do to fix this. If there are any consequences that are being levied against any responsible parties, what is being done to try to recoup the money, and very specific budget lines that explain how much money is being spent on conference attendance by DNR employees across the board from top to bottom. I'd like to know that.
Yeah.
I think, that's micromanaging under different circumstances, mm-hmm. but under these circumstances, that's, the public needs to know that, and the legislature needs to know that as we look at this year's budgeting. And as Senator Bach was suggesting, if there's any savings that we will accrue from reimbursements from the federal government, et cetera, and what the impact is of all of these expenses on those different funds. Those are all really important things we need more information about.
I don't see any other questions, and I think that was a very good sum of what needs to be done, and we look forward to your report, and we will certainly schedule meetings as appropriate.
Madam Chair, just for the members, all the questions you're asking, I'm asking. We're asking these questions. As I said, this is no small matter for us, and it's one that we need to get clarified so this doesn't happen again.
With that, thank you, Commissioner, for coming, and this meeting is adjourned.